Game Commission is back in session. Pardon us for taking a rather extraordinary amount of time for our executive session. Perhaps you're familiar with the phrase, if it ain't one thing, it's another, and it turned out to be lots of others. John?
Thank you, Richard. To start off this afternoon, we're going to go off schedule a little bit, and we have a special guest that we would like to honor in the audience, and my understanding is the department has an award of a recognition, and I'll kick it over to Director Don Cook.
Thank you, John. I'm Don Cook. I'm the director of the Department of Fish and Game, and as John mentioned, we have a very special couple of guests with us today, Harry Admonson, famous wildlife artist, and his wife, Betty, and we ask them to come today so we could express our appreciation with the commission of one more and a number of countless dedications and contributions that Harry has made to the state of California and to the fish and wildlife resource nationally. The department, as a lot of people know, we're retooling our duck stamp program, trying to really reinvigorate it and provide some incentive to really recruit artists. And we wanted to do something that would really kick that off with a bang and really start the program and get it reinvigorated. I should quit using that word because I can't say it. And so we went to Harry and asked if he'd be willing to donate one of his past works for the duck stamp project. And Harry said, no, I won't do that, but I'll be happy to paint you one. And so he responded with that generous donation, and it is our duck stamp. And I want to emphasize a little bit about why this is so special. Harry's 92 years young, and it's just an amazing additional contribution he's made to the fish and wildlife resource. He's probably raised easily in excess of $1 million for conservation through his artwork. And Harry was one of the very first Ducks Unlimited Artists of the Year in 1979 and certainly the first California Waterfowl Association artist. And so I'm going to ask Harry to come forward, and I'll meet you down there.
Thank you, Don, and congratulations, Harry. Thank you for everything you've done for the state. We really appreciate it. We're going to start the afternoon with one item that was carried over from this morning, item four from this morning, which is Department of Fish and Game report on implementation of the Marine Life Protection Act. We have three components of this report, an enforcement component, an outreach and education component, and a monitoring component. We'll start off with enforcement. Chief Nancy Foley, Deputy Director, Chief Deputy Director, well, you know, Nancy Foley.
I think it's chief to you.
No, it's something completely different to John. Good afternoon. Nancy Foley, Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. At the last Fish and Game Commission meeting, you asked me about four questions regarding marine protected areas. The first one was, what do we have? What do we need? How much is it going to cost? And what technology is available for the future? So we put together a presentation. I'll skip through some of the slides since Assistant Chief Warrington was able to answer some of your questions this morning. But I will try and answer those four questions along with one other one, and that is, what is the impact to law enforcement when you create an area like this? So I can start my story about the impact while they're figuring that out. Every time there's a new regulation that's created within the wildlife environment in itself, people say, well, you know, you're already out there, so what really is the cause and effect? Let me try and explain it to you in a context that you might be able to understand a little bit better than with a game warden out in the field. And that is, in the morning when a highway patrol officer is sitting off to the side of the road, and there are thousands of cars going by in rush hour traffic in the morning, if the only law that they had to look at was speeding, then that's all that officer would be looking at, was those people that are going and exceeding the speed limit. When they see somebody that's exceeding the speed limit, they'd go over and they'd make contact, pull the person over, do their investigation, write a ticket, end up with a report and going to court. Now, if there's a new law that's created that says on every Tuesday morning between the hours of 7 a.m. and 10 a.m., you're not allowed to drive a red car, then the officer sitting on the side of the road not only has to look for speeders, but now they have this new mandate that says you have to look for red cars too. So the officer is sitting by there. Thousands of cars go by, some of them speeding, but they see a red car. So they have to go over, and they pull over the red car this time while other people continue to go by. And those people might be speeding, they might not be. When they contact the red car owner, they also have to find out, you know, who the person is, what they're doing, if in fact the car is red, and what time is it? Is it really between 7 and 10 in the morning? If all of those elements are met, then they write a citation. Now, it's not just done at the citation, because then they have to collect their evidence. Their evidence might be the red car. Then there's evidence handling that has to take place. They have to write a report. Then, in fact, if the red car owner says it's not really red but mauve or something like that, then they end up going to court and having a court trial. So all of that takes time. And then at the end of it, there's always the disposition of the evidence after it's over. So every new regulation impacts wildlife law enforcement to some extent. So that will be my opening story. Thank you. So if you take a look at the first slide, which is the Central Coast study area, and what we have are 28 new MPAs. And in those 28, we have 68 new regulations. And we under some analysis we did, we thought we needed 24 positions to adequately cover the Central Coast Marine Protected Area. And that adequate is an interesting term, but we figured if we had two people available during an eight-hour period during the day, 7 days a week for that entire area, that would be adequate coverage. So what we did is we only got 9 positions out of that, and because of the way the funding came in, and we don't really have enough money to cover all 9 positions with operating expenses, costs of fuel, and things like that, but we did get 9 PYs. We created one of those as the captain, which goes along with the marine protected areas as they go through the different study areas, and that's Captain Naslin. So he oversees that entire project. My commitment was not to fill any of those positions until December of 2008, which is where we are now, because it took about 18 months from the hiring through the academy and getting the people off of the field training program. Those people are graduating or completing their field training process at the end of this week or next week. So we advertised the positions 2 weeks ago, and as of right now, we only have 2 of those positions vacant. So we have 7 of those filled, 2 vacant. Now, as you go through these, for each of the study areas, you'll see that we're just guessing as to how many marine protected areas will be created, so we can only guess as to what our personnel needs would be. What I can tell you is that it takes us about 18 months from hiring through the academy process, through the FTO, to get people on the ground. And through each of these study areas, the fact of the matter is that we don't have any current bills in the legislature to add additional game wardens with the funding to go to the marine protected areas. So these are the, just the, like I said, the rough guesstimation of what marine protected areas might be created. So that would be 132 new ones. This is what we have. This will answer that question. We have about 77 marine emphasis positions. That does not mean that that's the only thing they do. When they go out of their driver in the morning, they're supposed to look to the ocean first. But it, as happens frequently, if you have human-wildlife interaction, you have some habitat destruction, or if you have some other call that comes in you have to respond to, you're not always looking at the water. We feel like with the 370 positions that we have, we don't have enough positions to redirect to specifically look at marine protected areas. So what we have are 77 positions. And you asked also about assets. I believe that Commissioner Sutton asked about assets. And so we have our large patrol boats, which are 54 to the 65-foot class. We have one of those in each of our major ports up and down the coast of California. They are a law enforcement platform. They enable us to go out to 200 miles to sea and have overnight patrols and extended patrols of longer than just 2 days. Seven. The maintenance cost for any one of those boats on any given year ranges between $40,000 and $70,000. And as all of the boat owners on the panel know, boats are not cheap. And it costs a lot of money not only to maintain them but to also staff them. These are our 22 to 30-foot class. We've purchased a lot of the 22 to 30-foot class boats over the last couple of years, anticipating the Marine Life Protection Act and our ability to respond to them. So this is the North Coast Boat Patrol skiffs. And it goes, it's just showing you where these boats are positioned. We've tried to position them evenly up and down the coast. And all of this information will be available to you as well. We have a strategy to include our air services. All of the skippers for the boats and the pilots for our air services are game wardens. That enables us to use them in law enforcement and testifying in cases. And also it allows us access to some of the areas that would otherwise be restricted. So we have seven planes within the department. We feel that the Part Novias are probably the best planes to use in the marine environment. We purchased a new Part Novia just last year because one of our other ones needed some serious money put into it. And we just took delivery of that about 3 weeks ago. It cost about $100,000. I'm sorry. $900,000, and by the time we get it here from Italy, it costs $1 million. It costs about $100,000 to operate a year. And then we also ask the question about what's available to us, what can make our jobs easier. Equipment ideas for satellite imagery. We've done some of this with oil spills, where we've been able to access some of the satellites and use the imagery down below. It's very expensive. It's about $5,000 a download. Now, it could give us some of the information that we'd need in these areas because they actually can drill down to where you can see a CF number on a boat, see what they're doing, but right now it's cost prohibitive. So $5,000 a download. This is a great idea for unmanned drones, but again, the cost and the availability of it to civilians is restricted right now. But in the future, I think it's a great idea. We'd be able to do a lot of not only our marine protected areas, but our inland areas as well. Geofencing or ground-based radar, again, great ideas, cost prohibitive at this point. Geofencing is where you put a technical line around an area that when somebody breaks that line, that it will notify us that somebody's gone into an area or out of an area. We use it a lot now with tracking suspects through vehicles or other equipment that they may carry with them. On the water like this, there are a lot of shadows unless you have a position that's either very high or out on the water. And this is probably our most viable option right now, and these are remote cameras. There are a number of them in harbors up and down the coast right now. We can have access to some of these cameras. We can move them right, left, up, down. We have infrared imaging for the nighttime, and it's real time, so we have access to move the cameras around. It will show you anything, something similar to this, which is the Santa Cruz Harbor. It helps us with boats that say that they're landing fish when they've never left port for 3 years. It helps us identify people coming in and out of a harbor and when we might be able to catch offloads. But in all of these things, you still need a game warden to go out there and respond, because you can see all you want out on the water, from the air, in these harbors, but you still need somebody to go out and make the case. This was what we presented in 2005 to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and this gave you the different levels of protection for the marine protected areas, whether you wanted 24/7 coverage or the adequate coverage of 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you can see that it gets very expensive very quickly. And these next slides will show you why. This is a game warden's salary, benefits, wages, cost of living. You include OE&E, vessel cost, airplane costs, overtime costs, and the bottom line, as we project it out right now, with all of those costs included, would be about $300,000 a year. And then second year out, I think somebody will speak to this later, but second year, the costs are reduced because you don't have the training costs, you don't have the equipment costs, and some of those equipment costs will come due every 4 years. And because game wardens are game wardens, you also need the admin positions to support them. We've been poor at acquiring admin support staff within the department, so you have a lot of game wardens that are actually sworn law enforcement officers that sit at home and do bid purchasing, processing of paperwork, getting and purchasing pens and paper and things like that, where admin support, they really do that much better than any game warden I've ever seen. Then we have the engineers. Those are the people that can work on the boats. We don't always take them into yards. We generally would like to have an engineer on each and every boat. They're the people that are able to fix the boat on the fly. They also serve as a second operator on a lot of the boats. Because the boat is just a platform for law enforcement, the skipper doesn't always have to be sworn, but we do have a lead person as a sworn person. And so this is what we want. What we need. We're saying that we need 89 new positions for adequate protection of the marine life protected areas from the south coast to the north coast. And that includes 13 additional positions in this central coast region that would get us from the 9 to the 24. And that's what we need. That's what it's going to cost. Enforcement's expensive. Everybody knows it. But it's one of the necessary evils. As you walk down the road, you need monitoring, you need enforcement to be successful. So it's about $27 million a year, first year, and then 17.7 second year and beyond. And those are the answers to the questions that I was posed. Yes, sir.
Nancy, just a couple questions, kind of cut to the chase. First of all, some people have suggested, you will never find me arguing that we have sufficient assets to do the job. But as long as California has fewer game wardens than Maryland, we've got a big problem. And I think we all recognize that up here. And it's up to us to help you, find some of these resources that you need. That said, when I think about the marine environment, and I've done as much boat patrol as anybody up here, marine protected areas don't create new areas of ocean to patrol. Those ocean areas have always been there. Your wardens have been checking fishermen in those areas since you've had those vessels, right?
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing when we create marine protected areas is essentially, some people would argue, I think, that we're making your job easier. And I wonder about your thoughts on that. That is to say, when you have a marine reserve, at least, anybody fishing in there is per se in violation, and therefore that your job may be simply to go and make the case. With a marine conservation area, it may be somewhat more difficult because you're enforcing a new set of regulations and so forth, but you're enforcing this new regulations on the same ocean with many of the same people that you always have.
Mm-hmm. I go back to my analogy earlier with the highway patrol. Same road, same number of cars going down,
right.
Just a new regulation.
Yeah. So my second question, I guess, is we often hear lack of enforcement employed as an excuse by those who oppose the creation of marine protected areas on the theory that what good does it do to protect the ocean if you can't enforce those regulations? And I wonder what you think about that. Are you saying that until we get these resources, the Commission shouldn't create new marine protected areas, or are you saying you would like our help in obtaining those resources so we could do an adequate job of what we're about to undertake?
That's a good question. Actually, I think that enforcement has to be one of the key elements when you're going forward. You're expending a lot of your time, which is very valuable time, the Blue Ribbon Task Force, the stakeholder groups, to create these areas, and you want a baseline idea of what's happening out there before you create these areas so that 5 years down the road you're going to be able to have the presentations that you had today. Without enforcement, you're going to create these areas. You might have some monitoring from outside user groups, but if you don't have enforcement, then I believe that the numbers can be skewed because even if you have a reserve and you don't have enforcement, the numbers that are coming out of there may not be right. So, yes, I still would like to ask for your help in gaining the resources.
Mr. Richard?
Chief, thank you very much for that report. The analogy, I think, was right on target, and I also appreciate your candid and honest answers right there to Mr. Sutton's questions, because I think it is important, and it's an easy I'm positive everybody on this commission is in favor of the MLPAs, and I'm also positive that they recognize the severe understaffing that we have in our current situation with wardens throughout the state, let alone as we add on 68 new regulations and 32 new areas. So this is a major problem. A couple things I'd like to ask. I want to make sure that our staff has a DVD of this discussion here sent to everybody on the Blue Ribbon Task Force. I think it's very, very important that they're conscious about this and that their recommendations when they come to us are incorporating these. Whether it ultimately happens or not, I don't think anybody, least of all myself, and I'm pretty sure everybody else, is oblivious to the fact of the financial conditions within the state. By the same token, I think we have to be careful about being a party to the continued problem of adding more legislation without providing the money to actually enforce that legislation, whether it be wardens or whatever, school bonds or school programs or road building, whatever it might be. If we don't provide the funding, then it denigrates the effort of all the people that put in so much effort to make it happen. So I'm not saying it's an either. I want to make sure, particularly Commissioner Sutton, but everybody is clear. It's not necessarily either or in my mind, but it is important that we put it out there and that we back it up by saying, if you're going to adopt these things, this is really what it costs to do it. And then if those in control choose not to fund adequately, then they'll have to live with those decisions. But it's our job to be honest about what it really costs. It's frightening to me to think that we have 87 personnel, I think?
77.
That's simply for new MLPAs that we're creating. That's not talking about anything on terra firma. So, but regardless of that, we'll cross each of those bridges, as we will together. But I would hope that the commission as a whole insists that we make it a part of anything that we push forward. Whether someone else funds it or not, they'll have to make those decisions, just like as the MLPA's, the Blue Ribbon Task Force makes recommendations to us. Those are recommendations that we can modify, change, do whatever we think is appropriate. Same thing as we push it further up the hill. Others will have to make those decisions. But I think it's incumbent on us to be honest about what it really costs to do this and to do it right. Thank you so much for a great report, and thank you,
Mr. Gus,
commissioners.
You know, I'd echo those comments, and the only point I would further make is it isn't just the issue, of course, that if we don't enforce this, oh well. I think the greater consequence is the enforcement issues throughout the state and in the waters of what happens when we lose our resources. And then what then happens to the fishermen, and then what happens to whether you're a sport fisherman or a recreationalist out there and can't, and we have to shut down more. So I really feel we have to continue to make that point as well, that is what our enforcement issues are about. We need to stand behind it. We need to look for a dedicated funding source. We've got to make a change so that we get the resources necessary to adequately protect our resources.
I think these are really good remarks, Nancy, and I think you can take it up even one step further. This commission did not create the MLPA. This commission responded to the creation of the MLPA by the legislature. The legislature did not provide, in providing us with a mandate to do all of this, did not provide us with any funds to make it happen. Therein, in my opinion, lies the rub. I mean, it is the classic unfunded mandate. No matter how incredibly important it is that we do this, and I personally believe that I'm engaged in something that's literally historic in terms of its impact upon returning California to the sustainable abundance in the marine world that we once enjoyed. Having said that, it is excruciating that the legislature did not see fit to understand even the basic requirements of making this happen. It's really very sad. In fact, they get away with it all the time, unfortunately, and then crow to their constituents that they've done a good job when, in fact, they've done an abysmal job.
Mr. President, I think the MLPA would probably be better characterized as an underfunded mandate. That is to say, you know, we had to seek a public-private partnership to make the public process of the MLPA work, to actually do an adequate job of public process to create these areas. What we're seeing now, and what I think Nancy has outlined for us, is that we have a big disconnect between the elaborate and well-funded public process that, as elaborate as anything I've ever seen, frankly, that's working very well to involve everybody who wants to be involved in the creation, the development, and shaping and creation of these areas. And once they're created, we have an underfunded situation where we don't have enough people on the ground. It's not that you don't have any wardens out there. You have 77 Marine Patrol wardens. That's just not enough to adequately cover what you're going to have to cover. And I think you're right to project out what you need and give us those hard numbers, because we can work with those and with the legislature and the appropriators to try to make up that difference. I think that's really what we're talking about here.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
The next update for MLPA is Outreach and Education, Becky Oda from the Department of Fish and Game.
Good afternoon, Commissioners, President Rogers. I'm Becky Oda. I'm the Acting Program Manager for the MPA's project for the department. And like Nancy, it's a tough act to follow. I will be considerably cheaper, but not by much, on public outreach numbers. I'll be providing a brief summary for you on outreach and education that we've the efforts that we've done so far to date for the Central Coast MPAs, the cost of those efforts, and an estimate of what it might take to implement the whole MPA system once it's established coastwide. The reason Central Coast is being concentrated on is that it is the MPA system that has been adopted and implemented. North Central Coast is still in that process. While there are planning costs during that time frame, implementation costs are what we're concentrating on for public outreach and education for today. This presentation focuses on Department of Fish and Game costs so far, along with funding provided by our MLPA initiative partner, the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation. Regulations and business cards to date generated printed outreach materials in anticipation of the MPAs has been done. Business cards were printed up with basic information on them. These have been distributed to a lot of different areas of different businesses. Our samplers take these out in the field with them. They're able to distribute them when people ask a question about where they can get more information about the MLPA process. They are in our license offices. They are throughout the state. In addition to that, we have put together a regulations booklet. It was a booklet that was requested by the wardens to put together to outline the regulations for the Central Coast MPAs. And that was done, and it has maps and coordinates and boundaries and specific regulations for those individual MPAs. This proved to be so useful that there was a request by the public to also make that available to them, which takes me to the other public brochures that we have done so far for the Central Coast and printing materials as well as online materials. So what you're looking at now is a printed, on my left, perhaps your right, trifold brochure with a single map of all the MPAs in the Central Coast and their allowed uses. And then those have been distributed to sport fishing license vendors, DFG license counters, commercial fishermen. We take them to sportsman shows. We get them out there as much as we possibly can. The warden's guide that you saw before was actually put online for the public to download. But in addition to that, our MLPA initiative partners also printed up 8.5 and 11 copies and mailed them to key vendors like bait shops and dive shops. But certainly not, we have not canvassed the whole state as we would like to with all this information. In addition to printed materials, online materials, signs are very important in getting information out to the public. These on-site signs are a critical part of that outreach in addition to those printed materials. There are many challenges to creating signs, permanent signs. There's the funding, there's design and meeting signage standards for the various jurisdictional agencies like National Marine Fisheries Service, Natural Marine Sanctuaries, State Parks, and so on. In the interim, however, we created temporary signs. This is an example of a sign at Año Nuevo that were done in-house. They're laminated posters that can be put up in visitor centers, at kiosks, that kind of thing, that could be put over old information with regards to the MPAs, put up over outdated signs, and it was done in-house, so the cost that we're going to look at later is going to be hard to get to that because it was done mainly in-house. In addition to those temporary signs, permanent signs also need to be made for these MPA areas to help educate the public. These are standalone signs, not the posters or kiosks, but it is what is most needed to educate the public. Collaboration is the most efficient and cost-effective way to accomplish this. This is a sign from Lovers Point, Monterey, and at the bottom, unfortunately, you can't see all the logos, but it has the partners that work together on generating the design of this sign. And our role in that is to provide information and staff to those signs, look at the design, agree upon that, and then have them posted. DFG staff Mary Payton, Susan Ashcraft, and Elizabeth Pope Smith contributed to the design of that sign. We are also, the department's also a part of an advisory committee with other agencies and NGOs to prioritize sign locations and coordinating sign style and ensure the most effective use of the funding for these signs. Now we get to the funding. So far, for the cost of implementation right now of public outreach has been on the printed materials that I've shown you, and there's a lot of things that we've also done, public releases, those kinds of things, which you didn't get an example of, but there are a lot of in-house things that we've done. For the printed materials, it's roughly about $18,000 so far, and that includes for the printed material, including the design and the layout and the printing. And there were contributions from the MLPA initiative partners on getting those things printed up. The signage, Nancy said 28. I have here 29, so I'm going to give it to Nancy with regards to the number of MPAs. But there's $87,000 that was awarded for permanent signage. That accounts for roughly $3,000 budgeted per sign. However, that's only one sign for each MPA in the Central Coast region, which is obviously not nearly enough. There needs to be more than one permanent sign in each MPA. Our partner, the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, funded 16 of those signs, and then the department is on the docket to pay for the rest of those signs, which we currently do not have funding for. Again, there are other products, as I said, fact sheets, press releases, press kits, stakeholder kits, those kinds of things that are not included in these costs. It's just too hard to get to that in terms of how much does all the toner cost, all the paper cost. We could do that, but not, you know, for this presentation. So it's the cost it presented is the cost of the layout and design and production with external printers and mailing costs for the printed material. An important thing to note, because the MPAs, central MPAs, became effective before we had a DFG budget for that, and there was a spending freeze, our MLPA initiative partners, RLFF, helped to meet those informational needs by helping it to fund those signs. What's the bottom line for what we need? So far, again, this is what we've been able to do so far. The staffing has been those folks I mentioned, plus a public information officer to help with website design and so on and so forth. But what is it going to cost for the whole system? This is just for one region and not nearly enough of what we need to do to reach out to the public to educate them more about the MPA process. So what's the bottom line? It's a big jump from 120,000 to 1 million, but we've heard all day long the importance of public outreach and education on the MPAs. It can help enforcement with what they're doing. It helps the public understand. It gets them involved in the process, and it's one of the more important things that we do. So $1 million a year would include, we're estimating, and I have Deputy Director Jordan Traverso here to help me fill in any of the gaps that I may have missed here. But it sounds like a lot, but it's really probably more than this. If you're looking at printed materials that we've talked about and you're really doing it to get out to everyone you want to and need to reach, it's far more than $18,000 that we need to spend on that. Signage alone is expensive, and one per MPA is not going to do it. And we don't even know yet how many MPAs we'll have on the North Coast, not yet the South Coast or San Francisco Bay. So we have a long way to go, and there's no way to know how many of those signs we're going to need, but certainly more than one per each MPA. And then 2 to 3 full-time staff. We've mentioned already that collaboration is really important in working together on this public education outreach. And that takes time and it takes effort. And we need to be able to collaborate with our partners, work together to work on those signs. And that takes staff that we just don't have right now to be able to do that. In addition to that, this is not including inflation costs or changes. We have 5-year reviews for all of these MPAs. It's likely, potentially, that there will be changes to those MPAs, potentially. So anytime there's a change, we're going to have to change up the printed materials, the website designs, update the signage. You know, all those things have to be wrapped up into what is going to be needed overall in the whole MPA system. So even $1 million may be too little, but that's our best estimate at this point in time.
Thank you, Becky. Any questions?
Just a comment. If it hasn't already been done, I think that both, I didn't comment on Nancy's PowerPoint because she knows and the wardens know how I feel, but if they haven't already done it, I think that this PowerPoint and Nancy's are imperative for the legislature who created this monster in the first place to see. And we have to figure out some way to get that to them, at least their staff, so that it can be shared with them. So that's something to consider.
Well said.
I agree with what Jim said. You know, the fascinating thing is, you know, when you open this Pandora's box, we're not even, I don't know how deep in it we are, but I don't think we're probably halfway because we haven't talked about what actually the department has to do to implement and administer all of these kinds of things as well. And although I appreciate your report, I really would like to have known what you really think it's going to cost because it does. It's difficult for the for us. It's difficult for the Blue Ribbon Task Force to be able. We're going to need to quantify it at some point in time. We'll be asking Don Cook to do the same thing and say, what's it really going to cost us so that when we push this up, we can say, this is what the price tag is, by the way. You know, congratulations. We've done a really good job. We've done what you've asked us to do. But this is what it costs.
Yeah.
And we won't be right on that. You know, we'll be low again. But at least it will put it out there so that it has to happen. So I appreciate that. The one thing I noticed on your signs is I didn't see on the MPAs, Marine Protected Areas, where it said it's illegal or something. It was kind of a nice,
it's
here's a little
nice
map
informational
of the area,
sign, yes.
Where's the skull and crossbones, jail, guy looking out of jail?
Good kinda, idea.
You know, you really
touch one fish and you die, you know, that kind of thing.
Skull and crossbones would be a lot
cheaper.
It seems
like we should do something, though. It really says, you know, you cannot do something here. It's not just a, you know, hey, here's a little map for you.
Right, and
you
again,
so
yeah.
I would suggest that as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Commissioners, Jordan Traverso with the Department of Fish and Game. I just wanted to add a little bit to Becky's presentation based on what you're saying, your questions about what it actually will cost. Right now we're going with estimates from what we have spent, which is we're trying to make an assumption of what we could spend. Now with public education and outreach, it all depends on what you want and how far you want to go. I mean, we can do video presentations. We can do outreach in the communities. We can get to all the stakeholder businesses in each of these MPAs, in each of these areas. But it's very hard for the department, with the limited resources that we have, to dream as big as we possibly could. So we're trying to give an accurate assessment of what we really think. I mean, we could spend whatever we get, but the likelihood is that we'll get less than $1 million a year and we'll make it work. So, you know, it's very difficult to say.
Actually, that's been exactly the problem, though, Jordan, that we continue to do, we'll make it work with whatever you give. And at some point in time, we have to say, we just can't make it work. This won't work. And if you want us to do this job, you really got to give us what we need. Now, I appreciate and will validate your you could spend whatever, and I agree with that. I mean, we all could. I mean, I don't mean that in a negative
Absolutely.
Tone. If you got $10 million, you could do the fanciest programs imaginable every year and be off the charts. But there is a appropriate minimum standard that from the from your department's side that you would consider to be the minimum. You'd mentioned one sign, an MPA is not enough. Of course, and I agree. But whatever it is, that there's a minimum that we would need. And so we should be able to quantify that reasonably so. I mean, nobody's going to be executed here if it's wrong. But, you know, we have to have some baselines so that we feel, particularly me, and I think everybody, I'm not going to just say that. I think it's every single person up here. So we feel really comfortable that saying, you know, it's going to take 77, you know, new officers there and $21 million or $27 million the first year and 17 after that, and it's going to take $1.2 million there. And Don says it's going to take another. This is what it costs. Now, if you want to adopt it and you want to do it, then you should provide that. If you don't, you want to adopt it, you want to provide something less because I've said this to, I think, everybody that will listen to me on this. I'm not so foolish to believe we're going to get every dime we're asking for. But I believe if we put it out there and make the magnitude of the problem clear to people, we will get something, which is more than we're getting right now, which will be a start to be able to actually do the job correctly. And yeah. That, I think that's what I want to have, and I know that's what everybody else wants.
I agree with that. Jordan, I worked at a foundation for a long time where people asked me for money all the time, and if somebody had come to me, and which they frequently did, with what you just said, I always sent them back to the drawing board to try again, because your job, just like their job, is to tell us and the legislature what you need, not how you can make do with what you have. We all do that. But how much do you need? Nancy did a good job of it just a minute ago. She said, here's what we need to implement what we see coming down the pike. That's what's useful to us, because then that gives us something to carry to the legislature or wherever we need to go, the governor's office, to help get that amount of money. As Dan says, we may not succeed in getting the entire your entire needs, but you got to do better than just saying, well, we could spend any amount of money. Of course we could do that, but that's not the answer to the question of just how much do we need to adequately do outreach and education on MPAs.
And we believe that the $1 million figure per year is the minimum that we could do it properly with.
Yeah. And I think, Jordan, I think you've, and Becky, thank you, you've done a great job at putting out there at least a list. The one thing I would add to that is, I guess I'm a believer, and this is just from print materials anymore. I am so inundated with Christmas and holiday catalogs that I say, how much print material can I receive before I just zone out and throw everything away? I'm a firm believer in having great interpretive signs, permanent signs at key access points, not just within MPAs, where the people get to the coast and access the coast. And they're at piers, they're at launch sites, they're at various facilities along, and I'd really urge us to get a message out there with interpretive signage along the coast in various places that talk about this story, because it's whether you're standing right in an MPA or just south or just north of one, at least you understand what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, virtually all launch sites, obviously, that could access, and any single MPA would need.
And where the rest of us signage. Pedestrians go. Who maybe don't have ocean-going boats, but certainly enjoy the view. So.
Zonkey?
Yeah, I would just, as a department, we really appreciate this feedback. The point of this section of your agenda was to give you our latest estimates on what we think enforcement, education outreach, and you'll hear shortly, monitoring, recognizing those are based on expectations, and so what... It's a little hard to predict that, but what we'll be looking for on an ongoing basis as you deliberate these MPAs, the next area and the next, is feedback on what are you expecting out of that, and that will shape our estimates and the approaches we take. And all of these, the three, when you finish hearing the monitoring, they have synergy. They all work together. They all depend on each other. And so we will constantly be bringing back to you our latest estimates and ideas of how to implement the expectations, but we'll be looking from you what those are. And what we have right now is based on the things we've been hearing in the BRTF meetings and the public's input on expectations, but they are strictly minimal.
Right.
This is a Volkswagen version, just so you know.
And I think that's really what we should focus on. I mean, I don't think this is a time to be dreamers. But there's a minimum level of acceptability for you putting all this time and effort in, and for your efforts that you would consider, I've got to have this to do the job that you're expecting me to do. Now, as Jordan said, if you gave me 10 times X, I could do a really fancy job, but I've got to have this. I think, I felt I was getting that from Chief Foley, that this is what we need. Now, she actually gave us two or three choices on the level of staffing that you wanted to do, but number three was what she really feels you needed to do, two full-time, all the time, all that. So I think that should be the standard. What is the minimum acceptable level for you to perform the job that you have?
And what you're saying is the $1 million is that number.
Yeah.
It is, with the exception that I would say in public education and outreach, it's difficult to assess how well you're doing until after a campaign is through.
Sure.
And how well it's been accepted. But that would be absolutely the minimum.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions, comments? Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Becky.
And the last update is on monitoring, John Ugritz.
Good afternoon, President, Mr. Rogers and Commissioners, John Ugritz with the Department. You heard this morning a lot about monitoring efforts at the Channel Islands Marine Protected Areas, and I thought I would begin with a fairly good estimate of what it cost us over the last 5 years. By us, I mean not only the Department, but our partners in the process to get to the point of having the monitoring report you see. And the bottom line number for that was about $13.5 million over the 5 years. A portion of that was for document production in the last year, and a good amount of it was annual budgets for data collection and data analysis of the various partners. If you consider the Channel Islands approximately equivalent to one study region of the state of California, marine waters, and the average of about $2.5 million a year, you could multiply that out by five study regions, coming up with a number for monitoring of, again, about $12 to $13 million a year for statewide monitoring. Now, that includes some partner money. It includes some department efforts, but it's really not the whole picture. The other thing is that while there are efficiencies of scale, as we do things in more than one region in the state, it should get easier to do. There are also dramatic inefficiencies of scale in this process. Marine research and monitoring generally can occur only during a season, not through the entire year. And in order to do it statewide in a single season, you need extra staff, extra vessels, extra people out there collecting information, because you simply cannot have a 50 to 80 foot research vessel in multiple places at the same time. And obviously costs are increasing for any work we do on the ocean, with fuel prices and other costs increasing, at least a month before this. If we look at another area that we estimated, the Marine Life Protection Act initiative actually during the Central Coast process had a contractor estimate long-term funding needs to implement Marine Life Protection Act. Statewide for all areas, that report...
Say that again for me. Start over. Where'd this...
This came from the initiative process through the department and our partners. It was a contracted effort to estimate long-term costs to implement the Marine Life Protection Act. And that estimate was based on other efforts around the world, including at the Channel Islands, and how much they cost. The estimate there was, for all things together, about low average $20 million a year, high average $40 million. That included enforcement, that included research and monitring, that included outreach. So that was the whole ball of wax. For the Central Coast...
The 40s probably close, and the 20s probably not enough.
Probably low.
Yeah.
And you can read... In the report, there are details that I think would point that out as well.
Yeah.
And again, that was
a pretty good guess early on.
Several years ago, so costs have changed, and we've learned more about what it actually costs. For the Central California coast, the baseline monitoring over the last couple years has cost, again, about $5 million, about $4 million from Ocean Protection Council through Sea Grant, and another million or so from associated sources. And we actually have a report for you on the table that details the studies that were done in the Central Coast. We don't have results yet. We just have what the studies were and their initial findings. So, again, that's looking at a single study region over 2 years, about $5 million. Again, coming up with this, about $2.5 million a year. So the department has taken a look at a lot of those numbers, at the fact that we will partner for much of this work. There will be outside support for research and monitoring, and we wouldn't ever want to take on all of it ourselves just as the department, because there's actually quite a lot of benefit from working with the university scientists, outside scientists, fishermen, and the public in doing all of this work. That said, we've estimated that it will cost us about $12 to $15 million a year to monitor adequately in the full state for Marine Life Protection Act for doing research and monitoring and analysis. And for the first year, there would be associated extra costs, such as purchasing new research vessels, research equipment, supplies for new staff. Right now, for Marine Life Protection Act, we have on the order of $4 million a year and about 30 positions who at various times in the year work on Marine Life Protection Act. the vast majority of those people are a small group who are associated with the planning, who presumably eventually those positions could be redirected towards monitoring and research once the planning process is complete. We do feel that we need an additional $8 million a year in ongoing funds to augment to get up to that $12 million a year range and about 55 positions additional to help primarily with research and monitoring. A few of those positions could go to some of the other day-to-day management efforts. So bottom line, for monitoring and assessment and ongoing management portion, that's not including outreach and enforcement, is about $12 to $15 million a year in additional funds to the department, or actually total funds, and we have about $4 million now, so about $8 to $10 million additional.
Thank you, John. Any questions, Dan?
I've been watching those bailout hearings where the guys are up there asking for that money. You feel like that right now? I'm just kidding.
Yes.
Further questions? Thank you, John.
Thanks.
John. That's sobering, isn't it?
We have three public speaker cards on this. And along with what we were doing this morning, 1 minute each, please summarize your comments on these, on this. Jim Martin, Paul Weakland, Caitlin Gaffney.
Jim Martin, Recreational Fishing Alliance, and I really liked Nancy's report as well. I think she left one thing out, though, is the role that the public, especially the fishermen, play in enforcement. And that might be harder to obtain in the future. I think that also the commission needs to remember that, you know, the legislature probably isn't going to come up with all this money, and you don't have the power to shake it out of them. So what you do have the authority to do is to make sure that the regulatory package in front of you is enforceable and use your authority to make sure that it's cheaper rather than more expensive. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, it is said in the MLPA that if you can't afford it, you can't do it. It also states in there it has to have proven value and worth. We have not proven the value and worth of these marine protected areas, these economic dead zones, these no fishing zones. And this public-private partnership is quite worrisome. This is a sellout of government services to the highest bidder. Obviously, these foundations have an agenda. They have reasons for giving this money. This needs to be looked into, kind of like the governor in Illinois selling out the private-public partnership.
Caitlin Gaffney.
Good afternoon. Caitlin Gaffney with Ocean Conservancy. I wanted to comment on the previous three items and obviously very briefly. First, I wanted to state that, of course, Ocean Conservancy recognizes the very serious challenges that we're facing, particularly with respect to the warden situation, and we're committed to trying to seek the long-term solution there. Obviously, it's not going to be something that is solved overnight. I do want to emphasize, though, some of the comments we heard from Assistant Chief Warrington this morning and Russell Gallipo from the Channel Islands National Park, really stressing the importance of partnerships. That's the only way we are going to be successful at all of these activities, is to really look towards how we can all come together, how the state, federal agencies can share their resources, be efficient. We have partners on the Central Coast. We have the Monterey Bay Sanctuary. We have the Gulf of the Farallones and Cordell Bank Sanctuaries. We have the National Park Service in Point Reyes. We're going to have to figure out, as we have in Channel Islands, how to do this as efficiently and cooperatively as possible. And that's already coming together on the Central Coast. There are a lot more outreach activities and education activities underway than what you saw today. A lot of them are being done by partner organizations, and I think that's the future. We have to figure out who can do what, come together, and do our best. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Don Wilson with the Sutter Bypass Closure.
Sorry, sir. We're not at that item yet. We haven't called up public forum yet.
Sorry.
Okay, well, We're running a little bit late today, and now we are starting with the portion of the agenda that was going to be starting at, well, a little bit earlier. So we are on page two now, public forum, and we have several public forum speakers, and I just need to let everyone know that, remind folks that weren't here this morning, we're on live video. If you have speaker cards and you're interested in talking on any of the agenda items this afternoon, please fill them out. They're in the back. Turn them in up here. Also, keep in mind that we have a 10-minute aggregate on speaker time, so please choose your items wisely. We also ask folks that they keep their comments to the microphone, no catcalling or disturbances in the audience. That's discourteous to the audience and to everyone involved. With that, the public forum is any member of the public may address and or ask questions of the commission relating to the implementation of its policies or any other matter within the jurisdiction of the commission. As a general rule, action cannot be taken on issues not listed on the agenda. Staff will normally be requested to follow up on such items at the discretion of the commission. Submittal of written comments is encouraged to ensure that all comments will be included in the record before the commission. Please be prepared to summarize your comments to the time allocated by the president, which is going to be 2 minutes for public forum. With that, we can start. Dennis Byrne, and please line up along the edge here so that when it's your turn, you can get right to the microphone. Dennis Byrne, followed by Jim Bremmer, followed by Paul Pierce, and Vern Gehring.
Yes, my name is Dennis Byrne, and I'd like to start out by saying that I'd like to extend a personal thank you to the Commission and the Department of Fish and Game for initiating action to gather data on the Pismo clam fishery within the state of California. I understand that they're actually working today in San Diego gathering data and in preparation for a paper to be submitted to the public sometime to your organization this year, possibly next year. I think a special thanks is due to Pete Cavis, David Ono, and Ed Roberts and Steve Kronk for their work in helping this program get along. My other concern is the East Walker River. In March of last year, there was a very positive presentation presented to the commission by Curtis Milliron in regards to the West Walker fishery between Bridgeport Reservoir and the dam. Between the dam and the Nevada state line. There was one item in there that I did have some concern about. Commissioner Gustafson asked him to come back to the podium after the public input and ask the question, and I'll paraphrase, is there sufficient deep water ponds to sustain the fishery during low water levels? And the answer was yes. This is not an attack, but I personally know there's less than a dozen deep water holes over 4 feet between the reservoir and the state line. And these particular pockets of water hold a great population of fish when you have low water flows. After that meeting, I wrote a letter to the commission and submitted pictures of those holes that are accessible to the public for fishing. I have received no response back on that letter. That letter also included an invitation for one member of the commission to please at their convenience in the next 12 months to take a look at the East Walker River when it's in low flow levels because it's extremely detrimental to the fishery itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne.
Jim Bremmer, followed by Paul Pierce, Vern Gehring, and David Rudy. Jim Bremmer, is Jim Bremmer here? Okay, moving on to Paul Pierce.
Good afternoon. Thanks for allowing me the time to speak. My name is Paul Pierce. I'm a member of the Coastside Fishing Club based in Northern California here. A few days ago, I read an article in the Western Outdoor News regarding the offer from the Coleman Hatchery of surplus fall-run eggs to the state hatcheries. Unfortunately, according to the story, the millions of fertilized eggs were turned down by the state and not needed and are to be or already have been destroyed. As you can imagine, this has created quite a stir among California anglers. While returns to the Feather River and Nimbus have been low this year. Perhaps enough eggs have been taken to meet their collection goals. But why were the Coleman eggs not given to either the McCallmy or hatcheries to raise? Through the end of November, these hatcheries each had less than 100 adult fall fish return. These eggs could have produced smolts for ocean enhancement programs. Another alternative could have been to place them in river in egg boxes, or at the very least to allow the fry to be released into the Sacramento River. In a year when no commercial fishing and only very limited recreational fishing was allowed, and with the near-term seasons in question, these eggs were too important to destroy. California fishermen deserve to know why this was allowed to happen and who made this decision. Secondly, during the spring PFMC meetings, two of the California representatives on the council stated that any fall-run salmon was too precious to lose. In a year when Central Valley fall-run stocks have fallen to such low numbers that the commercial industry has had to rely on aid, and the saltwater recreational fishermen have been shut down entirely because of predicted low escapement. Why was the fishing allowed on the Sacramento between Knights Landing and Red Bluff? Has the data shown from coded wire tag recovery that only late fall fish have been caught and zero fall run fish, or have some of the fall run fish been killed as well? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. Sankey, do you have any response to the egg question?
Yeah, and the most appropriate person to probably speak to this is Neil Manji, the chief of our inland fisheries branch. He's the most intimately knowledgeable about this issue. Neil?
Is this spin out Manji? Or?
And 500 words or less, please. No.
All right. Yes. Coleman National Fish Hatchery, as you know, is on the Sacramento River and operated by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They have a mitigation goal of 12 million smolts. They have actually reached that goal. At the time, the Fish and Wildlife Service did not anticipate meeting that goal, so they took a lot of early fish to ensure for the anglers to meet that goal. And as time progressed, they understood that they found out that they were going to meet their goal, and they needed to take eggs throughout the entire run. So that left a surplus of, I don't know, I think they're talking about 4 million eggs or something like that, which is standard operating procedures for hatcheries, because you don't know if you're going to meet your mitigation or not, so you take as many fish as you can early. At that time, the Coleman National Fish Hatchery talked to the department and asked that whether the department could utilize these eggs. At which time, we were just finishing up our spawning at Feather River Hatchery, where we did meet our mitigation goals, and we were beginning our Nimbus or American River Hatchery collection also at McCallmy. At which time, we didn't have, we felt that enough fish in the American River, we'd meet our Nimbus goals, so it would not be needed for Nimbus. McCallmy, we knew we would be hurting, but at that time, we looked at the potential negative impacts that are associated with out-of-basin transfers of eggs from the Sacramento system to either the American, the Feather, or the McCallmy, at which time, I'll be here in front of you also speaking a little bit about our stocking lawsuit. The department did not feel that it was warranted at the time. We will meet our mitigation goals of two or three Central Valley hatcheries, and that we had to make a quick decision. These eggs were available at the time, and at the time we didn't need them, and we were still anticipating getting fish back to the McCallmy River Hatchery and others. So we said thank you, but at this particular time we have policy that we are not going to do out-of-basin transfers, and we need to look into the future on how these types of decisions could impact our stocking in the future. So.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions? No? Thank you.
Next speakers are Vern Gehring, Dave Rudy, Walt Manziel, Layla Monroe.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Vern Gehring with the California Sea Urchin Commission. A couple of comments. One I should have made this morning earlier when the Blue Ribbon Task Force was here. But anyway, I wanted to just comment. When you all and when we all in the public get together and we talk about and we get reports on the Marine Life Protection Act and MPAs, I think we really need to be clear about, and we hear reports about protection, about species that are being protected, about areas that are being protected, and about levels of protection. I think we need to be clear and represent the what's actually being protected. And the question is, what are we protecting resources from? And I would submit that it's not the broad-based, comprehensive protection from a whole host of threats in the ocean that we all know is necessary to really sustainably long-term protect the ocean. It's not the comprehensive protection that I think the public is expecting and is wanting out of this process, but it's simply protection from fishing. And to the degree that, resources need additional protection beyond the normal day-to-day protections that you and the federal government adopts through fishing regulations, MPAs may help protect fish resources. But to other areas that need protection, other things that are a concern, it doesn't offer protection to those. A couple of comments on the report earlier, the discussion about unfunded mandates. I think this is a classic case of unfunded mandates. My 28 years working for state agencies in the past, these kinds of issues are always addressed in two parts. So there was the original statutory language, the statutory program structure that was set up and adopted by the legislature, and part of that was the funding to go along with it. Many times, but not always, the legislature dealt with both at the same time. This is an example of the legislature not dealing with the same time. There are hundreds of examples like this that the legislature is now trying to deal with. Some of the problem of the billion-dollar deficit is because of unfunded mandates. In this case, you have a private funding, private money, however, that helps you set up a program that brings you to the ledge, basically, so to speak, but there's no money to carry out over the long term. You heard the report from the department. I think we've discovered another lesson learned. We've talked about lessons learned a lot in this process. I think one of the lessons is that we need to start actually looking for better alternatives or affordable alternatives to conserve resources, not alternative ways to duct tape an MPA process together. Thank you.
Thank you, Vern.
Dave Rudy.
Mr. President, just a comment there. Vern, as you well know, it's probably, as you suggest in your comments, it's probably unrealistic that we will get everything we need to implement any of these programs from the legislature. So therefore, many of us have turned to more innovative ways of funding or at least accomplishing what we're trying to accomplish. One of those is public-private partnerships. Another example is what you mentioned this morning, this Barefoot Ecologist Program, collaborative research, where fishermen actually participate in collecting data that would be useful for a fishery management plan or whatnot. So congratulations for that, and we need more examples of that kind of innovative ways. Instead of turning to the department and saying you ought to be collecting information and go and find the money to do it, you and your colleagues with the sea urchin fishery are finding ways to collect that data in other ways, and I think we need more examples of that.
And with that, we are working on a specific example with regard to MPAs for that application.
Dave Rudy, Walt Manziel, Layla Monroe, Don Wilson.
President Rogers, Fish and Game Commission members. In 1986, I was selected to be on the Director's Sea Urchin Advisory Committee, and a number of issues we dealt with. One was creating a size limit. We also made a decision to have some areas protected from sea urchin harvesting to see what would happen in Northern California. Two areas were set aside in 1989, closed to sea urchin fishing. And they've been monitored by the department over this time period. A scientific paper was put out in 2001. In fact, I handed that out to everybody earlier today. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it during lunch. But it's a scientific paper that shows what happens when you don't harvest sea urchins in an area. And the results are pretty clear. If you look there, the diversity and the abundance decreases after you stop harvesting the sea urchins there because sea urchins dominate the bottom. Anyway, I know you had a little bit of discussion over this in the October meeting at Santa Rosa, and there was some discussion amongst commission members as to directing the department to look into this. I just wanted to see if anything's been done on that. And And if you have a chance, please do have a chance to look at that scientific paper, because it is the best readily available science on what happens when you close an area to sea urchin harvesting.
Thank you, Mr. Rudy.
And to comment, my understanding is the department is, you know, the department did hear those concerns about urchins. We're not asking for an update right now, but, you know, hopefully in February when we get back on track with the MLPA regulation process, we'll be hearing more about that. Is that acceptable to the department? They did hear that at the Santa Rosa meeting, and it is being looked at, and it will be presented to the commission.
Okay, thanks.
Walt Manziel, Layla Monroe, Don Wilson, Paul Weakland.
Walt Manziel, Chairman Rogers, members of the commission, representing primarily myself with a couple of informational items for you. One thing, Mr. Pierce's comments and Neil's comments about Coleman Hatchery, that's in my backyard, so to speak, and I spent a lot of time there over many years. An article in the Red Bluff paper this last week commented about the extra eggs that they had harvested at Coleman Hatchery, and according to the newspaper article, the personnel at Coleman had promised they were going to rear these extra eggs, putting into use some little-utilized extra rearing ponds they had, and promising the fishermen they were going to not be wasted. Just there is some conflicting comments out there, apparently, in the hinterland. The second point I want to make you aware of, probably old news to each of you, but the Rural Counties and Schools Secure Act has been reinitiated for rural counties in California for federal funding for the next 4 years. In those counties which had RAC committees and working with the Forest Service, I encourage the department in counties where there are RAC committees to look at the possible sources of cooperative funding for all sorts of little wildlife management programs, improvements in habitat, and so on, because the money will be there for the next 4 years. Some counties like Siskiyou, Trinity, Shasta have significant funding available, and they're looking for good projects. So just be aware of that and work to see if you can make some use of it.
Thank you, Will.
Layla Monroe, Don Wilson, Paul Weakland, Jim Martin.
Good afternoon. My name is Layla Monroe from the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'd like to express that the NRDC is committed to working with the Commission and the Department to develop long-term solutions to both the funding challenges and enforcement challenges that we've heard about today. Today I'd like to suggest a couple immediate solutions that can help to contribute to solving these challenges. First, in 2006, the legislature actually amended the Fish and Game Code, stating in its legislative intent that to address the lack of funding that was required has required the department to restrict warden enforcement and to defer essential management of lands acquired for wildlife conservation. They therefore enacted Section 711 of the code, which required that the cost of commercial fishing programs be provided out of revenues from commercial fishing taxes, licenses, fees, and other revenues. Last year, the department prepared a report in April for the commission assessing its progress in that in fulfilling Section 711. They found that only about 22% of commercial fisheries management and enforcement costs had been covered by revenues. So the point is there that there's a long way to go, but there is also opportunity for the commission to act in examining with the department those fishing fees, commercial fishing fees, that are currently within the commission's authority to set. So of the 65 fees, commercial fisheries fees, there are about 40 that are under the authority of the commission. So we'd like to suggest that the commission work with the department to examine which fees are not appropriately covering costs. And we'd also like to offer that we'd like to work with the commission to clean up the code and unify those aspects of the code to allocate the authority to set fees with the commission if that is found to be appropriate. So thank you very much.
Let me get a little bit of a clarification here. Is it the NRDC's position that we can acquire the funding for the MLPA by raising commercial fishing fees?
No. This is one component of a solution to deal with the discrepancy between commercial fisheries costs and commercial fisheries revenues.
So it is the NRDC's position that commercial, the cost of a of managing and monitoring a particular, I'm asking for your input here, of a particular fishery should be met by its fees.
Well, with regard to commercial fisheries, that was actually the legislative directive contained in 711. So, yes, I mean, we do feel that...
So it's fundamentally, it's the NRDC's position that it wants to end a large number of commercial fisheries.
No, that's not
I suggest the,
position.
The NRDC do its math. Thank you for your discussion.
Well, just to put a more positive note, the Marine Resources Committee of the Commission has been looking at commercial fishing fees, as you suggest. As you know, they're divided right now between the legislature sets some and the commission sets another. That's a problem in and of itself because you can't have a comprehensive fee schedule for anything when it's split between the two authorities. So that is one thing that the MLMA evaluation, lessons learned evaluation that we're about to initiate with the Ocean Protection Council is going to look at and make recommendations on. We're going to use the Marine Resources Committee. I'm getting a little ahead of our agenda. I'm going to talk about this under an agenda item later, but we're going to use the Marine Resources Committee to further that discussion. Certainly, the department and the commission are both aware that we have a mandate to match the fee structure with what the department is actually spending on management. That, of course, as President Rogers has indicated, is easier said than done. And it certainly won't provide anywhere near the resources necessary to implement the MLPA or even perhaps fishery management itself. So we need to look at that and many other alternative or innovative sources of funding in order to come up with enough to pay for what we need here.
Absolutely. And if I can just respectfully respond.
My apologies for losing it. Okay. It's just that the NRDC is in a marvelous position to use its bully pulpit to work on the legislators who, in fact, give us the money to do these things.
And, sir, that's
and
exactly
so
what we're
far,
offering.
The NRDC has not done that.
That's actually exactly what we're offering, is to work with legislators and you. And I'd just like to say that
the
numbers...
But the mechanism, let me make sure I got this straight, the mechanism that you suggested was commercial fees.
Those numbers that I presented to you were taken directly from a report, a memo prepared by the department. And I'm just suggesting that those numbers be updated and we examine that as one component of solving the funding crisis. And I really welcome the opportunity to hear more about how we can best work with the legislators to solve this problem. Thank you.
Richard, I have a question for you. John, I think it's fantastic the NRDC has come up with a great idea on ways we can raise some more money. Can you tell me how much money we've spent defending lawsuits that NRDC's filed against us in the last year?
I don't have it parsed out myself.
Do you have any idea?
I'm sorry, sir, I do not.
I'm sure you don't. That'd be one way we could save a little money.
I'd like to hear the department name one lawsuit that we have filed against it on fisheries issues.
Oh, on fisheries. We just recently settled on the condor. That was NRDC was involved with that, but not on fisheries. If you're trying to.
That is the subject that we're discussing, ocean management and fisheries.
I thought we were talking about available funds within the department, Karen. I mean no disrespect to you personally, but I'd like to see some positive things here.
Okay. Next speaker. Don Wilson, followed by Paul Wicklund, followed by Jim Martin.
Hi, my name is Don Wilson, and I'm talking about the Sutter Bypass closure. I have the answer for all this is the security. We'll have our own private security out there from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., just duck hunting only, only during duck season, because the pheasant season's okay and the dove season's okay and the quail season's okay and the squirrel season and everything else is okay. So we can go up there and bring our own private security in there from adjacent other clubs that have their own private security. They'll come over there and patrol it 5 miles, post it, have an officer there from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., you know. And another note I want to say, too, is that on the lease between the Fish and Game and the Reclamation District, it says right there in the lease that they have to allow fishing and hunting. It doesn't say anywhere or nothing that we don't allow duck hunting. Nowhere. It says that we have, Fish and Game has to allow for hunting and fishing.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Merry Christmas to you.
You, to you too.
Mr. President, I have
I'm
to
sorry,
say,
please.
It, you know, I feel the same way about anybody who speaks to the commission, but it would be, I actually have very little idea what this gentleman was talking about. It would actually be quite helpful if people who testify say what the problem is, why it matters, and what they want us to do about it. Those three things are what we need to hear up here.
I want it reopened because they're allowing every other hunting there. The Fish and Game doesn't have an answer why they'd like to close it. They brought another officer here, Andy Ackerson, with a landowner that owns very little land there to testify saying, hey, these guys come off the levee onto our property, and which that isn't true. They have to cross a 10-foot ditch to get to that property. I'm proposing that to reopen this levee, since it's been open since 1947, that we'd bring in a security guard only during duck hunting, because we can hunt everything on the levee except a duck.
Okay, get your
and I'm just saying we need this open. We need the public land, you know, for the
okay,
disabled.
Mr. Wilson, we got your point. Okay, good. Thank you.
Paul Weakland, followed by Jim Martin.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I have handouts, 8 copies. These are my comments to the final white abalone recovery plan. From what I understand, the state of California's Department of Fish and Game put in no comments on the white abalone recovery plan. Is that true? My goodness. I hope you'll have time to read it. We hear that you read everything, so no worries. The problem is mismanagement of the abalone resource. What we want you to do to cure it is to open to the harvest of abalones immediately south of San Francisco County, San Mateo County, Santa Cruz County, Monterey County, and San Luis Obispo County. The reasons you gave for the closure are not viable in these districts or areas. The Farallon Islands, the coast of San Mateo and San Francisco and Santa Cruz have overabundance of abalones, harvestable, sustainable, yet there's economic viability. How many jobs have been lost to this mismanagement of the abalone? You don't want to talk about it. Nope. Don't want to talk about the withering syndrome that the Department of Fish and Game outplanted. Don't want to talk about the cibellid worm that less than truthful that has been eradicated from the state waters. It has not. We don't want to talk about the herpes virus that was imported from Australia that infests the abalone farms. You don't want to raise it to a catastrophic level of disease so that all the diseased abalones will be destroyed. It's terrible. It's wicked, sinister, and evil. And you don't want to address the problems. Just push it under. Manipulate the information. Huh? Manufacture data. Destroy the eyesores. Purge the files. Eliminate the record of anything that makes us look bad or corrupt. Right on.
Jim Martin.
Thank you, Jim Martin, Recreational Fishing Alliance. I had a question of clarification, perhaps Commissioner Gustafson. On your motion on the North Channel Islands agenda item, did that, when you said the
existing Channel Islands shall be reserves shall be considered. Did that include the federal portion as well? That was kind of what was in Joel's letter to you guys. Yes, it did.
No, I'm listening to comments up here.
Sorry.
Can you restate that, Jim? I'm sorry.
We had requested that the entire network of MPAs around the Channel Islands be considered in the gap analysis and the science advisory team's guidelines down there for the stakeholder group. And so they had questions about some of the maps are just showing the state portions, and your motion referred to existing MPAs at the Channel Islands. I'm assuming that that's federal too. And the whole network is the whole.
Adriana will respond to that.
Adriana can respond, but my thought was we can only deal with the state waters. But the federal closures and the federal information should be part of what the stakeholder group sees as an overall picture of the baseline. But
certainly
that
would be
the gap
a contribution
analysis
to the overall protection in the region. Well, yeah, but the Act also contemplates subsequent actions that are taken by state or federal authorities that contribute to the goals and objectives of the MLPA, and I think that it's really important that those federal portions be included in the scientific analysis. It's just common sense.
Well, I think, could we just refer this back to the task force and initiative? Yeah, and how they're addressing this and how it's reviewed. And then we'll also need some interpretation, I think, from legal as to what we can do there.
Jim, it also may be a moot point for many species that your members care about because, as you heard the scientists talk this morning, they're collecting data largely inshore, and because many of the species that are fished recreationally don't occur out in federal waters.
Well, I understand that, but I think, up on the North Coast, for example, there's the rockfish conservation area that's primarily, again, for yellow-eye, and I'm assuming that there's going to be attention in state waters about yellow-eye, so I'm just trying to get the credit for those closures, which are even more permanent than the state ones because you're going to have to go through so many different agencies to change those federal portions. You're going to have to go to the council, the sanctuaries, and the commission, so... On guidance, I think you need to give guidance to the regional stakeholders and the science advisory team how you want them to deal with that question. And so I wanted to make sure that I heard your motion correctly in that it was existing reserves at the Channel Islands, which would be contiguous out to 6 miles. Okay. All right.
That concludes public forum. Item number 2, Department of Fish and Game Legislative Report Update and possible consideration of commission positions on proposed legislation. And Don wants to introduce a new staffer.
Yeah. Commissioners, I'd like to introduce the person stepping to the podium right now. This is Susan LeGrand. She is the department's new deputy director for legislation, which I'll go over in my report and some couple of new appointments. Susan comes to us from the California Cattlemen's Association. She's also worked with Senator Sam Onestad when he was in the Assembly District. Years of experience with the legislature. We've had a good relationship with Susan and a lot of, when she wasn't with the department, a lot of collaborative efforts with folks up and down the state in terms of. So we really want to welcome Susan here, and I don't know if Julie Altman's still sitting in the back, but for this position's been vacant for over a year, and during that time, Julie Altman's been doing her job as our legislative representative and picking up a tremendous amount of responsibilities from the vacant position, so we want to really formally recognize Julie's contribution to all the hard work that she's done over the past year, really basically trying to keep two balls in the air. So, Susan, welcome, and thanks.
Thank you. It's good to be with you all here this afternoon. I was going to give a little bit of background on myself, but appears that you've already done that and quite hit the nail on the head there. I'm sure, as you are all aware, the legislature reconvened on December 1st for the start of this 09-10 legislative session. Thus far this year, we've seen the legislature introduce 100-plus bills. Some of those, yes, do deal with subject areas that are of concern to the department. Some of those subject areas are Delta Vision, renewable energy. And one that's going to be of particular interest to the commission, I believe, is Senate Bill 21, which was introduced by Senator Smidian, dealing with lost fishing gear. This bill is identical to Senate Bill 899 that was introduced last year and subsequently vetoed by the governor. Currently, department staff is in discussions with the bill sponsors to identify actions that can be taken now and in the near future. Some of those actions that are being talked about are the potential for an online database to cite known locations and to report new losses. In the absence of new funding, this type of program the department is committed to doing what we can with our existing resources to facilitate this important program. I have some summaries here for you of some of the bills that we've identified that we're going to take a look at, and I look forward to working with you all in the future.
Thank you, Susan. Any questions? Thank you.
We have two speaker cards on number two, Virginia Handley.
Virginia.
And Paul Weakland. Please summarize your comments to 2 minutes.
Virginia, I didn't see you there. Nice to see you.
Oh. Well, it's nice to be here. I just wanted to I wanted to pass this out. It says, we start a new legislative year, and each year I put a list of possible legislation, not in any particular order, and not all of these deal with wildlife. But I wanted to go over some of them. Some you've already heard ad nauseum. Some you could do by regulation. Some you would need legislation. Of course, we would love to see this commission prohibit the importation of the non-native frogs and turtles for the live animal markets. Just simply stop issuing the permits. Might make enforcement easier, too. Adding requirements about the nuisance control trappers, AB 1729 that had passed made it very clear, which this commission could have done themselves, that it does not include mice and rats, gophers, moles. So it does include all these other animals. We have nuisance trappers. They make hundreds and hundreds of dollars every day. Yet under the law, it's set in the law what you can charge for the license fee. You can raise it according to inflation, a certain percent. But we need to go back into the law and make it up to the commission to determine what that fee should be and not have it in the legislature and in the law because, as you know, you also have these trappers that they're not nuisance trappers. They may be selling the fur, but they are nothing in comparison to these nuisance trappers. They need some minimum standards, but we need to also raise that license fee, and you need to do that in the legislature.
What's the current fee?
I think it's about $49. Do you know?
It's a one-time $49 trap all you can trap.
Yeah.
And what is it you think is appropriate fee?
Well, when you're covering the nuisance trappers, I don't know. And also when we're talking about enforcement and administrative time and
I know, but you're talking about just the fees there. I'm just curious what.
Well, I'd certainly make several hundred dollars. Okay. I mean, they make the $49 and the, you know, before the morning's half over.
Okay.
You know? We have the, I won't go through all of these. I'd love to see enrichments required for all the animals under the exotic animal permits. It's in the law that we were supposed to have these regulations about the MOUs for inspections. We were supposed to have that done in 2009. By 2009, obviously, we're not going to make that deadline, and you may need to go in and change that deadline to give another year because you still have all of these regulations to look over and to make some changes. I'll just say the last one. Right now, we have it in the law that the commission has absolutely nothing to say about the frog jumps. And I don't see it anywhere else in the law where Fish and Game has no authority over the wildlife. I've been to many of those frog jumps. Those frogs are jumping all over the place. They're not necessarily going back where they came from. They're not going into the happy pond behind the barn. So we're just spreading these frogs out even more. Just need to go in and cross out that line in the existing law.
Has there been any frog abuse that you're aware of?
Oh, my God, they're either dead on the side of the road or they're eating frog legs in the barbecue. Yeah.
Thanks, Virginia.
Paul Weakland.
No, thank you.
Okay, that moves us to item number 3, receipt of Department of Fish and Game informational items. We start with receipt of Department of Fish and Game Director's Report, Don Cook.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'll try and speed through this in the interest of time because I know you've had a long day with your joint meeting ahead of us. Can we get the reorganization slide up on the screen, please? And
I think I saw
John was going to pass those out.
I think I saw that slide just as Nancy was about to make
I did, and that's why I had copies made for the commission because a couple of reasons. One, I couldn't read it.
There it is. He's got it.
Right. What I wanted to let update the commissioners on, you saw a copy of a DFG all email, but in end of November, the governor signed an executive order that really provided the department a unique opportunity to really take a leadership role in greenhouse gas emission carbon footprint reductions with renewable energy issues. And he directed the department to create a new division. And we did that as you look a little bit to the right of center, if you're looking at the Ecosystem Conservation Division down with Deputy Director Kevin Hunting. And this division contains a renewable energy and climate support and climate energy branch. That's a new branch within the department. We've been active in climate change, obviously, with Dr. Amber Paris that's on our staff. But this will really focus our collaborative efforts with the federal permitting agencies, BLM, as well as Fish and Wildlife Service, and the California Energy Commission and others as we move through trying to increase renewable projects in the state. It also really shifts our habitat conservation, our major planning programs, into a spot where I think that it highlights the significance of those efforts in the state. It also allows both folks internally in government as well as the public to easily find where their interests lie within the department. As you see, Deputy Director Sankey Mastrup is the Wildlife and Fisheries Division, which is basically containing anything. If it doesn't matter if you're a listed species or if you're a tule elk, Sankey's division is going to find that under his purview, as well as the fisheries program regarding both listed, non-listed fisheries. Sankey's also going to be doing marine policy issues, as he has in the past, as well as be our liaison with the commission. If you look at the administration division, Deputy Director Helen Carricker is a brand-new appointment. Helen has been with the department for several years. She was our former Assistant Deputy Director doing our budget work and a lot of our planning efforts. So Helen's a great addition to the executive team. And you just recently met Susan LeGrand, who's our new Legislative Affairs Director. Mm-hmm. With the exception of those changes of the new Ecosystem Conservation Division and the appointment of Helen and Susan, our organization is pretty much the same, and I'll answer any questions if you have. This was effective immediately.
And with the renewable energy, I appreciate the comments from the commission today about looking at unfunded mandates and, you know, how are we going to do this? This is new funding coming into the department from the Energy Commission. It's a grant. It's appropriate fund source to be using here, so we didn't take money from another pot and create a new division. I mean, certainly the administration and the departments, you know, we don't have any bags of cash or extra people sitting around. So that's how that was accomplished. Any questions on that at all? Great. I also want to talk about successes. I sat this morning through some of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and we looked at how that process worked. And with the three-legged stool you heard from the department, enforcement, monitoring, and outreach, we have a similar success that occurred end of last month, and that's an agreement in principle to remove four dams on the Klamath River. Three of those are in California, and one of them is in Oregon. It's an agreement in principle. We're actually meeting yesterday and today with the Klamath Settlement Group to really start moving that forward. It has a target date of 2020. There's going to be a tremendous amount of scientific investigations as well as cost-benefit ratio information displayed in a very transparent and public forum. The Secretary of Interior, under the agreement in principle, will make a decision in 2012 whether to move forward. It's a great example of a very diverse group of constituents coming together and solving a problem. And just like marine environment, there was a lot of long history of conflict, and it was really very similar to MLPA, watching people come together and figuring out we've got to change the way we do business. So that's a really good success story. Real quickly, I also want to give you a brief update on the salmon relief program that we've updated you on. In fact, there was a little bit of information that was in the news that the administration withheld, you know, some additional funds until it was out. Those funds have been released, so all $170 million have been released. We've been working with the California Salmon Council, and they're actively out making sure the public, especially targeting some of the Sacramento River fisheries, is well aware of this program and that they have deadlines to meet and the information that they need to submit to receive relief under this bill that was pushed by the three governors and the administration. And
what's your objective timeline to get all that out?
The deadlines for application is December 31st of this year, and that's why we've got the Salmon Council really helping us getting that outreach out there, not only the commercial recreational fishing, but the businesses that are dependent upon those fisheries.
Right.
You know, and so
I'm assuming if we don't distribute it, that it goes back.
That would be my assumption, but I'm always worried about assumptions. I can follow up on that.
Yeah,
Don, congratulations on the Klamath, the agreement in principle on the Klamath. I think not only is that significant in that it will be the nation's largest river restoration project after the Everglades, but it's also significant, I think, because having spent quite a bit of time up there, because of the way it came about, the Klamath Basin Settlement Agreement represents a new way of doing business in very contentious environmental issues where instead of litigating or, you know, after exhausting perhaps the litigation option, the parties actually came together, buried the hatchet, and started to talk to one another about what they could live with and what they really wanted, what would their respective communities needed, and it's really become a model of negotiation and understanding. So, congratulations, and let us know what we can do to help move that forward.
I appreciate that, and having been involved with it for well over a decade, and through the hatchet burying part and everything, the thing that I should acknowledge here, there's two groups that really took that first step, and that was the tribes along the river and the agricultural community that really said we need to figure out a better way to do business, and they deserve. I mean, the government, you know, acted a lot as staff, and it took the conservation community, everybody, but those two entities really stepped up, and they deserve a lot of credit for that initial.
Well said.
And so it gives you an example of what can happen in even really tough times in an environment. The last thing I want to do real quickly, I want to take the opportunity, I may be stealing the chief's thunder here, but Tuesday we had a really impressive event where the governor issued Medal of Valor awards, and we had three of our top-notch wardens that were awarded Medal of Valors by the governor, and then were hosted by the governor and the first lady at the Christmas tree lighting ceremony. And I want to point out that when I listened attending the ceremony, which was an honor, and pointing out what these folks did, and then you realize that they did things that they encounter every day. They were extraordinary what they did, but each one of our wardens does that. And so Mary Gregory, Josh Brennan, Wilbur Brown, all wardens did some pretty extraordinary things, and I just want the commission to be aware.
How does one swim with belt, body armor, boots, and save a drowning teenager? I mean, how does that work?
That, you know, especially when you meet Warden Gregory and you see what Mary's what she was carrying with her when she did that, and also the initiative that and the quick thinking she had to grab a fishing pole and swim not only through the surf with her all of her safety equipment, her vest, everything else, and what happens when that gets wet, but to have the forethought to bring a fishing pole with you so you could reach out to this young person, and you know she's really, you know, she saved a young person's life, and that's it was a moving ceremony, and yeah. Like you say, it's kind of the stuff our folks do on a routine basis. It's nice to see them acknowledged.
It's virtually an amazing story. I'm surprised she survived it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, unless you have any questions.
Any questions? That's it. Thank you, Don.
Our next item is 3B, receipt of Department of Fish and Game draft report on possible modifications to designated categories of various violations. Nancy Foley. And then from there, Nancy will go straight into her enforcement update.
Good afternoon again, Commissioners. Nancy Foley. I brought Julie Altman with me. She's our legislative representative. She has been here a lot longer than I have. She helped me through some of my first hearings as she kicked me underneath the table when I went into areas that I shouldn't have gone, and she remains in that position still kicking me under tables when we try and testify in front of the committees. But we have had a long history of attempting some legislation. I think Julie and I have gone back to 2002 with some of the abalone legislation that we have proposed. As you all know, the process when we propose something, it has many reiterations before it actually comes out. So the first time we went, when we understood the scope of the abalone poaching problem, we were looking for some felony statutes for that. We have a lot of difficulty in both the Public Safety Committee and the Judiciary Committee on the Senate side. When we get in front of those, most of our ideas sail through Water Parks and Wildlife and the resource committees, but when we get to public safety committees, that's where we generally have some difficulties. And there are generally the atmosphere is no new felonies because of the three strikes law, even though this isn't a violent felony. So we run up into a lot of opposition to that, and that was what Julie and I realized the first time we went in front looking for a felony for abalone violations. And then we've had a couple of tries at it since. And then most recently we looked at more enhanced fines and penalties for poaching on the whole, because we didn't want to keep going back species after species. We wanted to go for egregious poaching violations. We wanted enhanced fines and penalties and stronger charges to be able to be laid by the judge. And what we found is when we got in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee again, we ended up losing some of our enhancements on some of our fish commercialization, and the fine is actually now lower than it was before we went to them. So that's always the part about proposing a change, is you never know how it's going to end up. So we did get some enhancements on some things, but we ended up losing on others. So if you have a couple of minutes, I'd like to bring Julie up here to tell you about some of the history of where we've been.
Hi, Commissioners. Julie Altman, the Department's legislative representative. The Chief asked me just to kind of chime in here because we have spent a lot of years trying to get some of these penalties increased, and rather than just kind of explain the problems we had, I wanted to bring to your attention that if there is, in fact, an interest in the Commission, it seems like we're most successful when we can get a really heavy hitter majority party member to take the lead on some of these issues. One of the last big ones I remember was penalties for bear parts, commercializing bear parts. That was Senator Byron Scher, who was able to get a felony with a very significant penalty just because of his, you know, adamance about the issue. Last year, Commissioner Kellogg, you might remember Assemblyman Desaulniers tried to get some really higher penalties for just generally poaching, and it did really go sideways on us in Senate Judiciary Committee. So if there is something that you'd like to focus on and that we could, you know, kind of partner on, that would be wonderful, because it really does take a massive effort when we get in the committees that, you know, have a no new felony rule, for example. It's just not negotiable. That committee felt like they did us a favor by giving us even some little increases in some penalties while backing off in other areas. So if there's something in particular that you want to work on, let's do it.
Well, Julie, you make a good point, but it's actually flags an issue that I've been concerned about for some time. It's one thing for the department to go up and, you know, make the case, as you and the chief have said, get shut down or have something, you know, an unforeseen consequence happen. If, on the other hand, you put together a coalition of you know, hunting and fishing groups, mm-hmm. Environmental groups, the commission, and others, and we all go in our own respective ways up and ask for the same thing or build a powerful coalition of legislatures to do that, I suspect we'd have a greater chance of success. So we need to be better at marshaling all of our forces. Between the contacts that Commissioner Richards has among the, for example, among the, and Commissioner Kellogg and others, among the Sportsman's Caucus alone, you've got some very powerful legislators. So
right.
If we all decide that we want to work on something, and this is, I guess, is a good, I hope Susan is still here to hear this. We've been fairly inactive at the legislative arena in the last several years.
Right.
But we can be a lot more active as a commission, as a body, if we choose to be. Obviously, we have to choose carefully. But if there are things that we can work on together, we have the ability to build those coalitions by reaching out into our respective communities. And that seems to me to be a lot more effective approach.
Sure, and actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we did ask Mr. Martin to stick around, because he was with us in lockstep last year, as was John Carlson in the committee last year. So we do try to bring people in and run into these brick walls. But anyway,
actually, I'm glad you asked for some suggestions, and I'm going to pile on with what Mike said there. And as much as I like John Carlson, I think commissioners being there are going to make a big difference to you. And one of the things that we had asked Chief Foley to do was to come back to us and say, What are the, and I forget if we said 5 or 10 things that are most egregious that we need changed. And I agree with Mike 100%. We have tentacles that are impressive. There are a lot of people who are supportive of a lot of the commissioners here, a lot of different people. And putting together the right team to go see our friends in the legislature may make a huge difference. There's no slam on what you're doing or what Nancy's doing or John or anybody else, but this is just reality. That's how we got up here. It's a political process and at the end of the day. And so I am still encouraging Chief Foley to come back with what is it that you want to see done, and then we need to set up maybe a subcommittee here that will spend the time and say, who do we know and how do we have to go about this, and you can guide us through the process of the committees that we're going to have to persuade and see if we can find two victories this year and three next year and four next year, so that we can first and foremost protect the resource and put the bad guys where they need to be, felonies or not, no new felonies, it doesn't matter. But anyway, I want to encourage that.
Great.
So that means I'll be expecting someone to call me or Mike or Jim or Cindy or Richard and say, let's get together and talk about this.
Okay. Happy to work on it.
Good. Thank you.
So I think I remember John saying that we'll go right into the enforcement update after that.
Actually, before you do that, Nancy, does this past discussion that we just had a few moments ago suggest that we might entertain a legislative subcommittee again? Good. We'll talk about that then. Thank you, Nancy. Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt.
And understanding that any legislation that we might work together on now will be effective in 2011. So, I mean, we have at least a starting point, and we know where we need to be in 2011. So I appreciate everybody's support, and I agree that it will take all of us together to move some of this forward. We have encouraged our stakeholders to work with us in the past, although each of the stakeholder groups represented by lobbyists also have membership, which they have to try and protect. And that's, in fact, where we've come to some disagreement, unfortunately. Okay, so for the enforcement update, I am only going to give you good news today. I think others will bring the bad news as it comes, but I am only going to do good news for a change. And the good news is that for the first time in as long as I can remember, we are within five positions of being full. We made some hires yesterday. We are at 365 out of 370, and it was something that nobody ever thought we would be able to do. They should never challenge me on something and say that you can't do it, because we will. And over the last probably 3 years, we've hired well over 100 people with our own academy now. That certainly helps. We have 29 going into the academy starting January 9th, and we hired three of the laterals that went through our last academy that are self-sponsored cadets that went through our last academy. They paid for it themselves. They wanted to be game wardens. We weren't able to pick them up before that. We were able to pick them up yesterday. So that's good news for us, and I'm really proud to say that we have 365 game wardens today.
That's incredible.
Thank you. And hopefully that will make a difference to the resource, because that's what we're all about. And then the director did steal my thunder on the Medal of Valor. And I do have some pictures that were up a little bit earlier.
And Nancy, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read the press release. So if you don't mind telling us the stories, I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read it.
Certainly. This was 2 days ago, was the Governor's Medal of Valor ceremony. This is the third year that we've actually participated in it in a very long time. This year we had three recipients. And I think you can probably go to the next. Oh, maybe I can go to the next one. There you go. There are three award recipients. The person on the left is Warden Josh Brennan. He's out of the Butte area. And what he did was on a patrol, and you'll call a routine patrol for a game warden, you know, hiking down into a canyon. So he saw that there was a person down into this canyon. He had several hundred feet of rope in his patrol vehicle. Again, something unusual but expected of a game warden. He rappelled down into the canyon, found an individual down in the bottom of the canyon, face down in some water. He turned the person over. They were intoxicated to the point of not being able to care for themselves. He stayed there. It was late in the day. They called in for a helicopter rescue. Other agencies arrived. The helicopter came but was not able to evacuate the person at that time because it got to be too dark. The possibility for a rope rescue, again, because of the danger associated with the darkness and the steepness of the cliff, they couldn't do it. So all of the other agencies left, and our game warden and his lieutenant stayed with the person through the night in the canyon, hiking up and down the canyon wall a couple of times to make contact with everybody else. And in the morning, by themselves, they got the person out of the canyon by pushing him up the side of the cliff. So for that, Josh Brennan got the Governor's Silver Medal of Valor Award. You heard a little bit about Warden Gregory, who's in the center. In 2004, in the San Diego area, she was working one of the lagoons that has some major rips that go out, riptides that go out and to the ocean. She was checking one angler when she saw a 13-year-old boy get swept into one of these rip currents and being swept out to sea. She ran along the bank grabbing someone's fishing rod. When she got down to where he was, she couldn't reach him, so she jumps in the water with full gear, swims out to getting close to him. He goes under the water. She's afraid he's not going to come up. He comes up. She's afraid he's never going to come up if he goes under again. She just is able to reach the fishing rod out to him, and he grabs a hold of it. She brings him in. He holds onto her shoulder with all of that gear and all of that weight, and she's able to get to the edge of the bank and bring him in. And he turned 14 the next day.
So she had her firearm. She had her body armor.
She had everything.
Absolutely amazing.
And then we have our last award recipient, which was Wilbur Brown. Wilbur is a black belt and a very unassuming person, and he was working a plainclothes detail. He went to pick up a horse trailer for some backcountry patrol. A ranger flagged him over. I don't believe that ranger was a law enforcement person, and said that this, and pointed out a person that had just broken into a couple of cars. So Warden Brown went over, made contact. The guy pulls a knife. He's very agitated. Made some lunges at Warden Brown. Warden Brown had and could have been justified in taking this person's life, but because of his training and experience, he was able to hold the person off. The person ended up throwing the knife at Wilbur. There was a foot pursuit and vehicle pursuit for about a mile, wherein Wilbur and some other deputies that arrived at that point were able to make contact with the person, and after a little bit of a struggle, they were able to arrest him. But I think that it's important that we recognize people that have restraint when they can use deadly force and when they have that ability not to. So we recognize both that use it and that don't. So that was Warden Brown. So they were three awards that were definitely deserving by those game wardens. So I believe that was all of my good news, and so I shouldn't stand up here any longer.
Thank you, Nancy. Any questions? Wonderful report.
Item 3D, update on descriptive statistics regarding the aquaculture program. Aquaculture coordinator for the department, Devin Bartley. And commissioners, there is a handout that was placed in your stack today. Dan, I don't know if you saw this. There's a handout for this talk. Dan, there's a handout for today. This is this aquaculture item, and this was placed just this afternoon at your spots.
Good afternoon, President Rogers and commissioners. It's good to be back with you. It's good to be vertical.
What happened to you? Did you run into a tiger prawn or something?
No, it was worse. Mixed doubles tennis, and my Achilles heel paid the price. So this presentation I'm going to make now will summarize the handout that I've given to you, and it's in response to some queries by the commission. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is just summarize the status of the leases in California for aquaculture, talk a little bit about the numbers of species, their terms, the value of the product derived from those leases, the obligation of the growers to use state lands, some of the leases in other areas, and there was a discussion of, is the public interest being served by these leases? And then we'll finish up with a brief concluding section. Well, basically, the numbers and species that are being raised on these state lands is we have 9 owners that have 18 active leases. There's about 2,000 areas of leased water bottoms. Now, we have some private and locally owned leases up in Humboldt Bay of about 6,000 acres. The main species grown on these leases is oysters. And the oysters that we're growing are the Pacific oyster, the European flat oyster, Kumamoto oysters, and then our own native oyster. And by far the bulk of production is the Pacific oyster. Farmers also raise mussels, little neck, and manila clams. And a few of the growers are kind of experimenting around with scallops, the purple hinge rock scallop. The conditions of the lease, the minimum price for the lease is $10 an acre for leases of lower than 10 acres, $2 an acre for leases in excess of 10 acres. The average price in 2007 was $22 an acre. There's quite a large range. It goes from $2 up to $85 an acre. And, of course, this doesn't count the most recent lease to Marin Oyster Company of $4,000 an acre. That's an obvious outlier. These terms are planned to be adjusted every 5 to 10 years. And again, in 2007, the total rent for these leases to the state was about $30,000. The terms of the lease are also variable. The maximum, again, is set by legislature at 25 years. Now, this doesn't include the finfish leases. This is only for shellfish leases. Most of the leases of those 18, 13 of them are for, in fact, 25 years. Two of them are for 10 years, and three have more recently been renewed for 5 years. Now, the value of the product coming out of those leases is in this table in your handout, and you can see the five major growing areas in California from Santa Barbara up to Humboldt. And by far the most productive area is Humboldt Bay, and that's there are no state water bottom leases in Humboldt Bay. The $5 million generated from that area includes seed production. That's the only area in the state that has hatcheries that grow out small oysters, shellfish, and then distribute them to the rest of the growers in California for on-growing. They distribute to other areas in the country as well, not only to California. Now, in return for the right to use the state lands, the farmers do have certain obligations, and the main one is to actually use the land for what they say they're going to use it for. So we do have a proof of use requirement. They have to produce a certain number of oysters, and they have to increase that production by a given amount. And these amounts are also set out in the regulations. Now, if the farmers decide that they want to stop farming and abandon the lease, then they have to return the area to its original state. And to assure financial responsibility for them to do that, we've established escrow accounts in the major growing areas within the state. The farmers also cannot unduly hinder public access to the coastal area. Now, of course, they're farmers, and they can limit access to the amount necessary to protect their farms and to protect their products. Looking at California, I wanted to know what the lease conditions were like in other areas, and as you can imagine, they're extremely variable. You do have a little more complete table in the handout, but here on this slide, I've just summarized. I've picked a couple of the states out, and lease rates go for anywhere from 50 cents an acre to $500 an acre, depending on whether you're using the bottom, how much land you're using, whether you're using the water column. Terms also are quite variable, going from annual renewals to leases in perpetuity. Many of the leases are for 10 years to 20 years, and just about all of them have some mechanism to renew them. Now, there was a discussion on is the public interest being served, because in fact that's the main criterion for awarding leases to California farmers. Well, shellfish growers have an intimate connection with their environment. They need a healthy, functioning environment in order to produce a high-quality product that consumers will buy. And shellfish, and particularly oysters, are a high-quality product of both historical and current value. The industry started in the late 1800s, and at that point in time, California was the West Coast leading producer of oysters. For a variety of reasons, production declined until 1950, when we introduced the Pacific oyster from Japan. Then the industry took off again. Because of this intimate connection with the environment, oyster farmers and, shellfish farmers in general are stewards of the environment to the point that they help maintain the quality of that coastal area with habitat recovery, maintenance, and even enhancement. They do this through improving water quality, improving nutrient cycling, coupling the benthic and the water column ecosystems. They provide refugia, feeding, and shelter for a variety of marine species. The farmers also help with improved understanding of our coastal processes. Many of the farmers are involved in a voluntary marine biotoxin monitoring program where they sample their water and submit these samples to the Department of Public Health to help inform them about potentially toxic marine algae. They're also involved with the development of best management practices. Many of our farmers belong to the Pacific Coast Shellfish Growers Association, and that group has established environmental policies and environmental codes of practice that the farmers adhere to. They also are contributing to improved information on the production and value of California's coastal ecosystems, and this will in turn inform processes such as the implementation of the Marine Life Protection Act that has to take into account the other uses of the coastal environment. Just one, I know we've heard a lot about Drake's Estero and the eelgrass issue, and it might be a little bit difficult to see on this slide here, but what it actually shows is that in 1991, there were about 368 acres of eelgrass in areas of oyster farming. Now, in 2007, that area of eelgrass almost exactly doubled. And this is in an area of farming, very productive, as you saw from that first table, one of the most productive areas of oyster farming in the state. So you can see that farming oysters and fish habitats such as eelgrass beds are very compatible activities when done as it's being done in Drake's Estero. Now, I should also point out that throughout the state, there were increases in eelgrass beds, and I'm not implying that it was because of the oyster farms that these eelgrass beds increased, but certainly it shows that the oyster farms aren't hindering the reestablishment of eelgrass beds. Now, in conclusion, I would just like to say that I think a review and revision of the terms for our shellfish growers lease, I think that is coming. Rents for water bottoms are extremely variable. On a national level, California ranks on the high side, but not the highest. We've recently had farmers who saw their lease go from $2 an acre up to $65 an acre, and they were actually happy with that, or they accepted it. When we tried to reduce the term of the lease, or talking about reducing the term from what's currently 25 years lower, that's where they have a little bit more of a problem. They would like the longer term lease. Shellfish growers, as I said, are strong advocates of healthy coastal ecosystems and actually can help improve those ecosystems. We've gotten calls numerous times when other polluters of the of their habitats are other users of their habitats are polluting. The oyster farmers are the first ones to call us and notify us and try to help work out a solution. I believe that in fact the public interest is very well served by the shellfish industry in California. And this should be taken into consideration when we go ahead and review or revise their leases. We will be working with the farmers more closely in the future, and the input and guidance from the commission will be necessary and greatly appreciated. I'll be organizing meetings with the growers, and if any of you would like to participate or have input into those meetings, that too would be appreciated. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
I don't really have questions. I have a couple comments. First off, welcome back. I've been anxiously waiting for you.
And you're smiling, so that's good news.
That was an excellent presentation and covered, I think, just about everything that I was curious about and enforced some of the fears that I had, I might add. I don't think it's probably appropriate or necessary right now to fine-tune all that. I would simply say that I would ask two things. I don't think the department should renew one lease until number two happens, which is at minimum myself, and I'd ask the chairman if you would consider me as one person to work with the department on leasing and valuations and some ideas I have, which might be able to increase the revenue sources for the department, not to the degree of putting anybody out of business, but there's got to be some reasonableness, and there are a number of factors there. And again, I don't think it's appropriate right now to go through all that, but just a whole lot of different things that I'm pretty sure I can be helpful on, and maybe take $30,000. I'm guessing Dr. Bartley makes more than 30 a year, and so maybe we could at least cover his salary.
How about a raise?
Not much.
Sonke, you...
Yeah, just so everybody's at the same level of expectations, I have a question that I think is important. Devin, given the request of Commissioner Dan Richards, do we have any leases that are coming up soon? I'm trying to figure out the timing here, make sure we don't violate your directive there.
Timing would be now to start working on them, though.
Okay.
And if they're not renewing for a little while, then you don't have to worry about it.
Okay, I just didn't want to review one tomorrow and accidentally get you on our...
No, don't renew any for a little while. Right.
Are there any impending that...
Yeah, this one on that's gone from $2 to $65, that's sort of... in draft form now, and I think they're working on the language for the time. So
brakes on it.
You want the brakes put on that one?
I would. There's no sense in going on with any more. I'd like to stop.
Dan, how available are you to provide consultation to the department? Are you ready to rock?
Absolutely.
Good. I would
have to check with.
Since that's your business, I think it's a good way to go.
Yeah, I would have to check with my colleague who is actually doing the lease to know what signatures have been put on it or not.
Good. Sounds good. Well, you guys will commune, and we'll figure this out.
So I take it by this, I'll have Devin Bartley work directly with Commissioner Richards.
Well, how would you wish this?
That would be my preference. Devin, of course, will keep us in the loop, but I want to make sure we get the timing down so you're satisfied and we know what's expected, and then we can pencil out how quickly we have to move based on any leases, because as you know, if one of these expires, it creates a nightmare.
I think John Carlson will be involved in that.
Yes, that'd be fine.
Keep me in the loop, Sonke. Yeah, the expiration, that's those kinds of limitations we need.
Yes, we have to research that very quickly.
Dan, thank you for bringing this up, and thank you for volunteering to do this effort. Well, good stuff.
Thanks.
Yeah, and Dan, Mr. Commissioner Richards, I wanted to thank you for your patience on this.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. No. I just wanted to thank you for your patience. You were
your
most patient, and as Devin obviously had some wheel problems, we'll work this out. And I was going to ask the same thing, that John Carlson be in the communications loop.
Yes, absolutely. Needs to be. Good. Wonderful. That's good stuff. Okay. Go ahead.
Item E, update on automated license data system. We're going to defer that. We're going to hear about it. My understanding is either today or tomorrow, right? Or are we going to hear about it?
We're going to cover it here. We've had a couple
years.
Of minor issues here, and the person who has the PowerPoint is at another urgent meeting right now. So we'll either get it done this afternoon or tomorrow.
A few minutes after 13 years isn't so bad, right? Item F, update on hagfish fishery and the experimental gear permit process.
Sorry. I was waiting all day to give comments on ALDS. Is there any chance I can?
Yeah, we're going to take public comment for this whole update when we're done with this update. So in a couple of minutes, we'll start the public comment on that.
Okay. I didn't know if you were putting it off another day.
Well, the presentation might not happen until tomorrow, but you can make your comments in a few minutes. We'll get to public comment on this issue. Maria Vojkovic.
Thank you, Commissioners. Maria Vojkovic with the Marine Region. And I have a very short hagfish presentation to remind you. Commission meeting, you directed the department to work with some commercial fishermen who had petitioned you for authority to operate some hagfish gear under an experimental gear permit. And we've had conversations with those individuals and have determined that in order to do this experiment to reduce gear interactions, ensure better hagfish condition, and then determine what bycatch might be coming out of this fishery, that you issue or authorize three permits for the three individuals that requested them, that you require a $1,500 permit fee. It will allow those people to fish with this different type of fishing gear. We would be doing at least 9 days of observation on the vessel, each of the vessels, and asking the permittees to fill out logbooks so that we can get information about all of their fishing activities. One of the issues that arose while we were having conversations with these fishermen was the fact that they didn't want to have to pay the $1,500 fee all at once. They wanted an installment plan. Unfortunately, the department is unable to accommodate that request. So my recommendation is that you give us the opportunity to provide these permits to the individuals. Any one of them may choose to take us up on it. I know that I saw a letter that came to the commission this week from one of the requestees. So I don't know for sure whether they will or they won't, but we're ready to be able to provide a permit if they choose to do it. And just for your information, that $1,500 fee will only give us a few days of observation. We're going to be relying on their data from their logbooks to really inform us.
Any questions about the hagfish? Nope. Thank you, Maria.
Did you need a vote on that, or you just asked for permission?
I think it would be a good idea that you authorize that permit, and so then we can put it together like you do for the herring.
I guess I didn't realize we were voting under updates. So as far as procedurally, if we just give guidance, this is not really...
Yeah, it's not a regulatory action. We just need direction that you... They're your permits, actually.
Sure. Yeah, is it
under your authority. So if you're okay authorizing them, we will go through the process of issuing.
Is it the sense of the commission that is the way we wish to proceed?
Yes.
Thank you, Maria. Please.
Thank you very much.
So, excuse me, then we'll refer the person who wrote in to you for specifics of getting a permit then. Does that sound okay?
Thank you. We will write up the specifics of the permit like we do for the other experimental gear permits that the commission authorizes.
Okay.
So we will do that.
Okay.
We'll work with you.
Procedure question then, do we agendize that for approval of experimental permits, or is that done now?
I think we will still have to approve the specific experimental permit.
We'll talk about that then. Fine.
Thank you, Maria.
Update on halibut trawl gear.
Hello, Maria. You hid from us, and now you're back.
Thank you.
I love that segue, Maria. That was great.
Well, it looked like you were expecting something else, so I moved off camera there. So I'm standing here today because this is a result of several conversations that have taken place in the commission arena about the halibut trawl nets that are used in the California halibut trawl grounds off of Ventura and Santa Barbara. And you directed the department to work with the industry and with other interested parties to define what this light touch gear would look like, and with the intention of putting those descriptions into regulation for the fishery. So we have determined the six or five different items there in front of you about head rope length and the mesh that's used or the twine that's used in the nets, the weight of the doors, the fact that foot rope chain could be used, and specifying what size that foot rope gear could be, and then to not allow the use of roller gear or discs on the bottom of the nets. And I have a paper, actually, that's been signed by all of the active trawl fishermen in the halibut trawl grounds that they are in agreement with these net specifications. We've also worked with enforcement about their needs relative to this type of a regulatory action. And so I guess what we would be asking the commission is to consider this tomorrow in your calendar of regulatory actions for this next year if you're wanting us to move forward on preparing some package for you for next year.
So you believe it's discreet enough so that we wouldn't have to integrate it into an FMP, which could be quite some time off, but this would be discreet enough and relatively easy enough to be able to do in the regulatory calendar.
Yeah, you have no requirement to go through an FMP to do a regulatory change.
No, I understand that. The other option would be to wait. And
yeah, you could wait. Again, this is a response to...
I understand that, to an imperative, a time imperative. Yeah, thank you. Any commentary from the fellow commissioner?
And the letter that Maria was talking about from the department or the memo is in your late correspondence package here. I don't have anything for H, which is other. I don't know if the department has anything they wanted to add. Sonky's reaching for his...
Yes, okay. Sorry. I'm a little slow to the reach. I'm sure you've heard the only other item is an update on the fish stocking settlement. There's been so much confusion about that. If you would like, Neil Mangia and the director and several are here that could explain exactly what happened. Otherwise, we could move on. It's your discretion.
I think it's the sense of the commission we would like to hear about that. That's very interesting.
Is Neil still here?
On your feet, Mangia.
Hi, sir. Neil Mangy, Fisher.
Yeah, Crash Mangy.
Yeah, Crash Mangy. Uh-huh. What I have here is two documents here. One is a stocked waters log and a non-stocked waters log. As you may be aware, about a year and a half ago, there was a lawsuit brought on by the department that we were not following CEQA regarding our catchable trout stocking program. We went to court and lost that lawsuit. And the outcome of that was the department was required to put together a CEQA document. We have begun that document. It has been delayed to an extent due to, you know, trying to incorporate federal funding and things like that. We now have a new date of January 2010, which is about a year later than when we thought we were going to be able to finish this CEQA document and subsequent EIS, EIR. At that time, since we were going to miss our deadline, we had to go in front of the judge and let them know that we are asking for an extension. The judge decided to go ahead and grant an extension if, in fact, we can meet certain criteria under an order that the plaintiffs had written up. We were very uncomfortable with that. We had about 48 hours to meet with the judge and discuss our issues at a 20-minute session in front of him, at which time the judge ordered us to go back and work with the plaintiffs to try to come to an agreement for interim measures and interim order, or stocking would basically halt in the state of California. So we did our homework. We got together with the plaintiffs for about a two-week period came with some understanding on where we would allow stocking and what criteria. It was a long 2 weeks in negotiations, and I'm happy to report that the judge did sign an order on November 20th allowing us to stock 771 waters, but there are still 192 waters that are on the non-stock waters list. It does affect several of the regions and counties, but we were very pleased with what we have, and we are going to continue to work with the plaintiffs to try to come up with some other criteria to allow us to stock other waters. The main ones that we have that the commission should be aware about is reservoirs over 1,000 acres. We were given the green light to go ahead and stock. And also, which is very important to a lot of businesses, is the fact that places that have concessionaires that stock their own fish to try to bring more people into their lakes were allowed to go ahead and go forward with that, given the fact that they've had a previous permit dating back to 2005, and they stay within the same numbers and species. The only other thing that we have to we had to agree upon is the mitigation hatcheries. There's a lot of federal mandates that require the department and others to stock fish, and we were able to get that on approved also. And I believe the judge was very surprised that that there was mitigation required with our salmon and steelhead hatcheries, so we had to educate both the judge and the plaintiffs. So right now we're looking pretty good, and we're going to try to do our best in the future to do some more stocking and some more work on that. This okay. all stems from approximately, well, right now 25 species that both the Center of Biological Diversity and Pacific Rivers had issues with, and they're very specific in certain areas, and they're general in terms of steelhead, things like that, and others, but we were able to do that.
So. Thank you, Neil. Any questions? No. Great. Thank you. Thanks. Okay.
We have public comment on the overall department update. Please keep your comments to about 2 minutes. We'll start with Jerry Carnow, followed by Walter J. Maltz, followed by April Wakeman, then Mike McCorkle.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Always a pleasure to see you again. Just wanted to thank you guys again for continuing to tell the public and everybody in your circle the importance of the fish and game enforcement component that basically keeps the Department of Fish and Game together, and we're the face of the department. I'm Jerry Carno. I represent the Game Wardens Association in California, and I just picked up on a couple things. One, that you'd mentioned a subcommittee, legislative subcommittee, and if that comes to be, I'd like to offer up the Warden Association to be part of your toolbox if that's the case. The other thing is, Commissioner Sutton, you mentioned the fact of working with NGOs. Warden Foundation, or the Warden Association, for the last 2 years has basically laid the foundation for that. We have, as an example, Safari Club International, NRDC and the Safari Club had, or the Sierra Club had authored, co-authored a op-ed in regards to game wardens, basically titled The Endangered Species, Fish and Game Wardens in California. We have coalition letters from Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, California Waterfowl Association. We've worked with California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, Defenders of Wildlife, Action for Animals, Virginia Hadley's group, if Virginia's still here, and they have testified alongside the Warden Association in this warden, game warden shortage issue. And along those lines, with what Chief Foley had said, I'm sometimes I feel like I'm the doomsday guy, but the positions are getting filled. The department's doing a great job as far as recruiting. Our wardens and the Warden Association continues to do recruiting efforts, but that being said, in the next 3 years, our understanding is that there are about 75 officers that are going to leave, or they're eligible for retirement in the Department of Fish and Game. 75 officers in the next 3 years, which is, it was tremendous for us. So I just would like to be here to answer any questions you have and go from there.
Thank you, Jerry. Any questions? No. Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
What do you think? Wait, I have one question. On the you can't get away that easy. What do you think? You have 75 potential retirees, but if we're running right at 30 recruits through the academy, shouldn't you be able to keep the positions filled?
What are the main problems?
You lose a lot of talent, of course, and a lot of expertise, but it's just filling the position. Shouldn't we be able to do that?
The problem is it nearly takes almost 2 years to create a game warden. You don't just hire a fish and game officer off the street. You basically have to go through the state hiring process. They have to have the requirements at least 2 years of state of college. They have
Hang
to.
Hang on, it can't be that
it
hard.
Takes
Sutton was one.
I understand that, but the academy is.
He was federal. That's very different.
Requirements are somewhat higher.
But it basically takes a year and a half to get to the process to where you have an officer out hitting the road on the. You know, like our academy is one of the longest in the state for peace officers. It's nearly 30 weeks, and then the FTO program is 3 months. So by the time you have an officer going through the training process and the background investigation, it's nearly 2 years.
I think you're going to have to add a swimming course to the academy.
Well, we'll just have Officer Gregory be the training officer on that one for sure. But anything else?
No. Good.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Walter J. Maltz, April Wakeman, Mike McCorkle, Jim Martin.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman and Commissioners, good evening. It's already getting late. My name is Walter Maltz, and I'm a retired businessman here in Sacramento. I owned a data processing company, and I've been in data processing for about 30 years of my life. And I interfaced with the California Department of Motor Vehicles, and my business was selling driving records to that I purchased from California and 49 other states, and sold them to retail insurance agents. And we did this what you'd call online. An agent would put in a request. The request would go through us to the motor vehicle department, and back would come the information, or some updates would come and go back and forth. What I'm here to talk about is ADLS. I've been waiting all afternoon to hear the update. I've been buying fishing licenses all my life here in California, and I've added up the time I've had to spend buying fishing licenses, probably about a day and a half if you add it all up. You know, in the morning you're running to get on your boat, you're cold, you're trying to buy coffee, the guy in front of you is trying to buy a fishing license, and your boat's going to take off, and you've been through it, I'm sure, if you've ever gone
fishing.
You're
preaching to the choir here.
Okay. Now, we know we need an automated system. There's no doubt about it. And why, I've been doing, creating new systems, electronics systems, for years and years. And, of course, I thought of this thing a long time ago when I was buying my license. What's going on here? Now, I had some prepared notes. I threw them away because I see at this meeting everybody's interested in money, revenues, et cetera. Okay, real quickly, the time to create this system has been wildly, wildly underestimated. And I have some news for you. The cost of this thing and the cost after it's implemented has been wildly, wildly underestimated. There's $30 million approximately budgeted for this. Once it's implemented, it's going to cost you money that no one in any of these documents have spoken about, things that no one's brought up. And they're going to be, it's going to hit you hard by the time this is ever implemented, if it is implemented. The system is way too complex. There's too many things that I've seen in the system and these documents that should be reinvestigated. And I'm here, I'm volunteering my time or whatever to go over some of these things with anybody who wants to listen. But I know what I'm talking about. If anybody knows American Driving Records, we're a wildly successful company, and we did things with the DMV. They know me, and they know my reputation. So I'm retired, like I said, and I'm willing to go over any of this stuff. I think you're going to make a big mistake if you continue on with what you're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Miles. Commissioner Kellen?
Well, the biggest thing you said in your comments was if it's ever implemented, and my comment is don't worry.
That's the same.
Right between Don's eyes.
I've talked to a lot of bait shops and tackle shops and throughout the state, and I've gotten some really funny stories from all of them. And if you talk to most people here at Fish and Game, I'm not talking about you gentlemen or you ladies, but if you talk to somebody out there in your offices and mention this, you always get a smile. This could be done very simply. This could be done very inexpensively. If you just make some minor changes in the whole philosophy of what you're doing, this could be up and running in 6 months. Yeah. And you could be getting revenue in 6 months.
I would leap to my feet and scream hallelujah. But yeah. Thank you. And we will keep your card on file.
That's okay, I gave a lady here the my
no, we have
document.
It. Good, okay. Thank you.
One last thing. Has anybody checked with the Department of Motor Vehicles about using the driver's license information from the back of the card and whether you can transmit that information over the Internet?
Interesting question.
When I was in business, we were not allowed to transmit that over the Internet. It had to be over a phone line. I just wanted to know if anybody ever checked on that.
Don't know. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
April Wakeman, Mike McCorkle, Jim Martin, Paul Weakland.
My name's April Wakeman. I'm representing the Sport Fishing Conservancy. And I assume my late letter got distributed. Thank you very much, John. And I'm happy Mike's going to speak after me because I'm talking about the light touch trawl gear. A question arose that the commission made a decision to leave the trawl zone open based on the information gathered through both the department and a collaborative study. The trawl gear regulations proposed don't say anything about double caught end, and maybe Mike can answer whether a double caught end was used or not used during those studies. My understanding is with a double caught end, your meshes can, in effect, make the caught end smaller, thus reducing increasing the bycatch, and Mike can answer that question. If a single caught end was used in the studies, then we would recommend that the regulations also include that. And then the second item is under what's known as the trawl bill, the commission is given authority over all the halibut trawls, not only in the California halibut trawl zone. And we suggest that the regulations, instead of running with the California halibut trawl zone geographically, run with the California halibut trawl permit, because that is under your authority. And that's simply a question to be answered.
Thank you, April.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions? Thank you.
Mike McCorkle, Jim Martin, Paul Weakland.
Hi, Mike.
Excuse me. Mike McCorkle, Southern California Trawlers Association. I would like to thank you, President Rogers, for something you said a little earlier in the meeting.
Must have been some time I lost it.
I have a handout here that describes the rules and regulations of the caught ends in the double caught end, which was used in the California halibut trawl grounds. On my boat, when I did the study with the halibut team, John Richards from Sea Grant, myself, our biologist, we had a double cod in. On the net you saw on the video on Morgan Castagnola's boat, he had a double cod in. We invented the double cod in the 80s. We started with shrimp fishing as a bycatch reduction device. And we used it for a few years, and then the Fish and Game saw it, and they looked at it, and they made it legal for us to use that. So we do use the double cod in. If we use the single cod in, you can see on the picture in the back what happens. Not very many fish get saved. So the double cod in, you save more fish than you do with a single cod in. If we had to use a single cod in right now, we'd be out of business because we wouldn't be able to save any halibut. The escapement is the same in a single or a double cod in for incidental caught fish, which you can see in the study we did. So we would recommend that you allow the net to be built, the double cod in to be used on a net, which it is now. It's legal. It says right there it's legal. Built to a certain specification. About a month and a half ago, I was boarded by Lieutenant Castro, John Castro, on board the Coast Guard cutter Halibut in the Halibut trawl grounds. And he asked me if anybody had measured my cod in lately. And I said, well, not lately. And he said he made me pull my net up, and he measured it. And he checked the meshes with a disc to make sure they're 7.5 between the knots. He counted the meshes down, where you can see there it's 25 meshes or 12 feet, whichever's greatest is allowed. He then counted them down the rib line to make sure they were tied mesh for mesh to the rib line, and they were. And so then he told me that this cod end is fine, it passes, and if anybody boards you in the near future, tell them that I checked it and everything is fine. They boarded me a week later, 20 miles away. I was at El Capitan Beach, and they checked me again, but he didn't check my cod end. So we do use that cod end, and it's very important that we continue to use it. The law says we can use it. The other thing about going and taking this same net and going into the complete halibut fishery, up in Half Moon Bay, San Francisco, Avila Beach, Morro Bay, those guys that fish halibut up there also fish sole at the same time. They're working on it. They have not only a halibut permit, but they have an A-trawl permit. So they're trying to catch sole and halibut at the same time. So you put a net like we have up there, they won't catch any sole. It'll all go through the net. And they use rubber discs up there, and some of them use some rollers, not big rollers, but they call small foot rope. So this would eliminate all that. And it would screw those guys up really bad. And it would be a huge output from them, I mean outcry, if you did that. And so we'd like it, I would suggest that you leave it just the way it is for now. If you want to revisit this sometime, you better get a hold of some of those people at fish halibut up in the North Coast and North Central Coast and see how they feel about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Any questions?
I did.
Thank you.
I would like to say for Commissioner Richards, I did go notify all the boats. I did go talk to the Vietnamese. Since I speak fluent Vietnamese, it wasn't any problem talking to them. Actually, one of them's son was born in California. That's how I talked. But they have no problems with it. We just had to explain what they would have to do, and no problem at all. And the other fishermen, there's even some additional fishermen on there that could come. A couple of them are in Monterey Bay that fished in Monterey Bay, and actually when we were allowed to fish in Monterey Bay, they use the same net we're using down here. They're now in Half Moon Bay because they can't fish there anymore, but I got a hold of them. They don't have any problem. Nobody I talked to had any problem with this net specification. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Jim Martin, followed by Paul Weakland.
Jim Martin, RFA. I just wanted to touch on the comments by Julie Altman and Nancy Foley about the legislation and the legislative effort that we all need to make. And I appreciate the comments of Commissioner Sutton about how the outdoors community and the environmental community needs to work together. We worked with the NRDC, if I may use that term, Richard?
No, you may use that term. I am not biased against the NRDC. I just didn't like what I was hearing.
But Kate Wing did a really good job in helping us work with, we had to build consensus for what the options were that we were asking for, and it would really help if some of you commissioners would show up with us. We have a problem with some bleeding hearts in the Judiciary Committee that do not want to add any jail time to any kind of poaching case. And what really concerns us, not so much the infraction level, somebody going across a line of an MPA, I'm talking about the illegal commercialization of wildlife. And there's a lot we can do there. In my conversations with Nancy, she said the only thing that's going to make a difference is increased jail time. That's the only thing that gets the message across. Fines are just a cost of doing business. So RFA is ready to work with all of you, and let's get that done. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I like that.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. It's very upsetting, the update on descriptive statistics regarding aquaculture program. Well, all we talked about was oysters and an attempt to farm scallops, but he didn't go into any detail. Nor did he talk about the abalone farming, limpet farming, sturgeon farming, tilapia. We were hoping that would be a concise and complete report on aquaculture, and we didn't get it. Again, you're manipulating information. You've got the eyesores you don't want to expose. You don't want to be talking about this limpet scandal that's going on with this KLA drug that is so beneficial to many people as a therapeutic substance, and the value of these limpets that the people of the state of California are getting ripped off on because we're not paying any tax for this, the sturgeon farming and all the problems with the mutations, the tilapia and how there's problems in all of this aquaculture facilities. But what really bothers me is there's no mention about the abalone farms at all and the abuses that have happened here and the brood stock collecting permits that are being able to used and the enforcement on a lot of these things. What was that? And then the guy fled. He's not even here for public comment. Can we have a better report on aquaculture? This is lacking.
Thank you, Mr. Wigan.
With that, Mr. Weakland, you have used your 10 minutes for today, your aggregate 10 minutes. Moving on to item number 4, receipt of commission informational items. I'd like to give a couple updates to the commission. One, under tab number 4 in your briefing binders, there's a couple of letters sent to John McDowd. John McDowd spoke before the commission at public forum at our last meeting in Huntington Beach about a lobster permit, about a commercial fishing permit, and we wanted to point these letters out. You asked us to follow up. If you take a look, you'll see what the charges were against him back in the late 90s and how that was dealt with, and those still stand, or those letters, you know, are still in force, just as an FYI. The other thing I'd like to announce to the commissioners is at this point, we had for next year, February 4th, we had it set up as a placeholder for an organizational assessment and planning meeting for the commission. I'd like to put that off as a to be determined because on that day, there's two other issues that are going to be happening. There's going to be a statewide county commission meeting here in Sacramento. And staff and some commissioners will be involved in that, hopefully. And then we're looking at potentially an MRC meeting that day, and then Mike will talk about that in a second. So if it's okay with the commission, the organizational assessment and planning, I need to find another date for that in 2009.
Any questions or comments about that?
We don't have any cards, speaker cards on item 4. I can move to item 5.
Go ahead.
Subcommittee reports and recommendations, Marine Resources Committee.
Thank you, John. Just a couple of items. First and foremost, I would like to welcome our new commission marine advisor to the staff, Dr. Craig Schumann, who's here in the audience. Craig, stand up or let everybody know who you are. Craig
has a great deal of experience working with fisheries and other ocean issues, and I think he's going to be a tremendous addition to the commission staff, and certainly will help us organize our meetings of the Marine Resources Committee much better than we have been able to do in the past. The other significant news, which will be announced shortly, is that the Ocean Protection Council received six proposals for the MLMA Lessons Learned Evaluation study that they are funding. They've gone through an elaborate ranking process as required by state law and policy, and they are proposing an award date for that contract of the 18th of this month, of December. And so we'll find out on the 18th who the consultant is that we'll be working with. We plan to use, since this is a project that, a joint project with the Ocean Protection Council, the Commission, and the Department, we all had a hand in ranking and rating the proposals. We would like to use the Marine Resources Committee as a venue to take this study forward and for the consultants to meet with our stakeholders and the Commission and the Department and so forth. Not the only venue, but certainly an important one to foster that coordination. And so the next Marine Resources Committee meeting, as John just alluded to, will be scheduled for Wednesday, February 4th in the afternoon from noon to 4 p.m. That's a tentative timing, and it'll be announced through the regular calendaring process. But it's the day before the February Commission meeting, and it's here in Sacramento as well. So we look forward to seeing everybody there. We're very excited to get going with this MLMA study. We have a lot to cover. The study, as I mentioned before, will not only be a retrospective analysis of the performance of the MLMA over the first decade of the statute's existence, but will be a prospective analysis and come up with a series of recommendations for any legislative or policy or regulatory changes that might be needed to make the implementation of that statute more and California's fishery management more effective.
Item 5B, L. Tauscher's Preserving Hunting and Sport Fishing Opportunities Advisory Committee. Any of the commission? Right, I think John might speak to when our next meeting.
Yeah, tentatively scheduled for January 29th.
In the Sacramento area?
And that'll be in the Sacramento area, yes, at January 29th.
Tentatively.
Okay. Yes. Area.
And we're open to having that in Southern California sometime also, Commissioner Richards, down the line. We have one speaker card for item 5, Tom Raftikin.
Good evening, Mr. President, Mr. Director, members of the Commission. Tom Raftikin, Sport Fishing Conservancy. I just kind of want to emphasize how important. The last time we had a Marine subpanel meeting, Marine Resource Committee meeting, Barack Obama was a little-known freshman senator from Illinois. So it's really important. And I think one of the other things, Commissioner Richards, you touched on let's look at aquaculture and basically put together a subcommittee to look at that. And I think a legislative subcommittee. In almost every body, the subcommittees are where the majority of the work gets done. We clearly need a budget subcommittee so you can set priorities for the Department of Fish and Game. And I think your last meeting, the department submitted a list of for the regulatory calendar, went over enforcement, fisheries, wildlife, aquaculture, license revenue branch, and went down at the bottom and said next steps. And in none of the next steps did it have a committee meeting. The committee is a chance for everybody to get together and informally go over what's going on. Commissioner Kellogg does it in the Tauscher Committee. But we really need it's a chance to get many of these ideas vetted and get public input at the same time. It really is beneficial. So we heartily endorse getting that marine subpanel back online, and probably the top issue there should be getting rid of the display of recreational fishing licenses so we can join most of the other states and put them on our wallet like normal people. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Item number six, receipt of federal agencies informational items. We have Tony Morton from NOAA Fisheries.
Good evening, Tony.
Well, almost. It's 6 o'clock's evening, right? Well, hello, Commissioners. Tony Morton with NOAA Fisheries. As we all know, we've got a new president and a new administration coming into office next month. So we at NOAA, just like all other federal agencies, have been busy working with the transition team and providing them with information, in our case, particularly with regard to ocean resources and the major issues that we see coming up there. And we've been asked to provide our list of what we think are most important in terms of proposed legislation and funding related to that. So I thought I'd go over with you a list of the top seven that we've identified for both the administration and the what will be the 111th Congress. And first up will be the NOAA Organic Act. That was something that was first proposed to be enacted into law in 2004 by the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, and we've been trying to get that done ever since. NOAA was actually formed by an executive order in 1970 and has never had a statutory basis for its activities and missions. Instead, we've been operating under 200 different authorizations. An Organic Act would provide the basis in law, and we believe it would help better manage oceans and coasts, and it would provide us with the ability and the authority to get more towards an ecosystem-based approach, which I think we're all interested in doing. Secondly, it would be legislation to establish a national climate service. I mentioned that earlier this year, that a climate service was being proposed as a way to more efficiently bring together the various sources of weather information across the nation and bring it to the American people, and this act would authorize that. Third, reauthorization of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Authority to appropriate funds under the Marine Mammal Protection Act expired in 1999, and attempts to accomplish a long-term reauthorization of that act have run up against concerns by the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Marine Mammal Commission, who share implementation of that act with NOAA. So we're still trying to work through those issues. A National Offshore Aquaculture Act. This act would authorize the Secretary of Commerce to establish a regulatory system for offshore aquaculture in the exclusive economic zone and to mandate a marine aquaculture research program. This legislation is very controversial, and there's increasing pressure to move on it because of ongoing regional aquaculture activities and a desire to establish some national oversight to those activities. Legislation for international fisheries stewardship and enforcement. This act would authorize the Secretary of Commerce to list and take enforcement actions against what are known as illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing vessels. And it would authorize the provision of fisheries, technical assistance, and capacity building to other nations. A law called the National Fish Habitat Conservation Act would provide support for a dozen or more regional fish habitat partnerships throughout the country. And then finally, we have the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. As you know, that act was reauthorized last year, but legislation is needed to ensure that full funding is provided towards the requirements of that act, specifically related to annual catch limits and accountability measures to end overfishing, and to implement limited fishing access programs and to improve international cooperation in fisheries management. There's many more. Some of them are mixed in with this as subsets, and there's a lot of other probably less significant but still important legislation that's being proposed, but those are kind of the top for us. And finally, I just wanted to add my congratulations and appreciation to Director Cook for his work on the Klamath for all these years, and most particularly with the accomplishment for the agreement in principle. That's something that NOAA has been intimately involved with for many, many years and very interested in. I realize it's just a first step, but it's an important step, and there's a way to go, but we're heading in the right direction, I think. So.
That's really well said, Tony. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's a big, important step. Right?
Yeah. Any comments or questions? Thank you, Tony.
Thanks.
Thanks, Tony. No speaker cards on this one. Number seven, receipt of legal counsel informational items.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Deborah Barnes, Deputy Attorney General. There are no items under this.
Thank you, Deborah.
Item number eight, New business? Drop the gavel.
We're going to, not yet. We're going to have the update on the online licensing tomorrow then.
That is my understanding.
Yeah, Commissioner Richards, we had a dilemma this afternoon, right, in terms of some events we were required to be at in the last moment. So Sonke or I will be able to do that tomorrow if we can't find John.
Perfect. Thank you.
So we could shoot.
He fled the building.
We do have some information and an update. It's not a trust me. It's coming later.
Keep me posted on what time. I mean, we could do it first thing at 8:30 or move it a little bit later. Okay. Depend.
Should we recess until tomorrow? Any comments? No questions?
8:30 tomorrow morning in this building.